Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of The Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the wonderful island chained paradise nation, surrounded by Fukushima radiation, so that when you go sunbathing, you still soak up the rays. And my very special guest today's is Stephen Berry from Auckland. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Vinnie.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do, mate?
Well, I've been involved in politics for probably about 15 years now. When most people were having fun and playing pranks and going to parties at high school, I was studying politics, which you can imagine did wonders for my social life. I got started in the ACT Party when I was 16. I was with them for a couple of years. Then when I turned 19, I decided to run for Parliament as an independent in Mount Roskill, which is obviously spectacularly unsuccessful, but I wasn't put off at all. Following that, I discovered libertarianism and joined the Libertarians Party, which probably destroyed my political career for quite some time.
As it does.
But I did stand for Mayor of Auckland in 2004, did reasonably well in there.
Out of how many candidates, where did you come?
I think I came fifth, just after the Christians Against Abortion guy, but I did manage to crack the 1,000 vote mark, so I was pretty happy with that.
Excellent.
Yep. After that, I kind of lost interest in politics for a little while, did my own thing, focused on my work. I work in supermarkets, been doing that for 15 years, and then probably about 3-4 years ago, with the advent of Ron Paul in the United States and saying, hey, maybe this libertarianism thing can go somewhere, I got interested again and stood again as an independent in Tamaki. Once again, spectacularly unsuccessful, to be honest. I was going to join the ACT Party again, but when John Banks was their sole MP, I just couldn't bring myself to do it. So I got involved in the Libertarians Party again and worked on a rebranding effort to try and bring other parties together, such as the ALCP, a new grouping at the time called True Liberals. Unfortunately, it didn't work out. Libertarians is no more. But as part of that rebrand effort, we came up with the concept of Affordable City, which is a nationwide local body political party. We had parties standing in 7 boroughs around New Zealand. Got 45,000 votes around the country collectively, which goes to show that the model was quite sound. And in Affordable Auckland, we ran 3 council candidates, as well as myself for mayor, and someone in a local board as well. Didn't get anyone elected, but we did get some very good results. Nico Cloten in Franklin picked up 23% of the vote for council. I got third for the mayoralty myself, which was a bit of a surprise, but a very pleasing one. And now with the election over and Len Brown's scandals, we're focused completely on getting his resignation, and that will culminate in our protest on the 22nd of February at Brito Mart, 12 noon, for Len Brown to stand down.
Yeah, and when it comes to the election of a mayor, one thing occurs to me, particularly with the advent of the super city, is that it puts it outside the price range of most people who would be running for what I would say genuine reasons and what have you, and more or less allows for massive corporate interests, like, for example, the Committee for Auckland, to come in and back the candidates that will support their agenda rather than a candidate that will come in and support the people in reducing rates and increasing the amount of freedoms that we actually have in our city, because it occurs to me that they seem to be shrinking more and more as days go by. One thing in particular that struck me as quite frightening was around about the Rugby World Cup. We did a protest and we had one of these little council people in a yellow jacket telling us that we can't hand out flyers at a protest. There was even a huge protest in the middle of the street and what have you, with hundreds of people, and still these council people were telling us that we can't hand out our own flyers to other people at our own protest that we've got a council permit for. The sky's the limit when it comes to restricting people's freedom, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And as time goes on, we just see more laws, more regulations, more bureaucrats controlling what we can do with our lives. And I'm certainly trying to roll that back through the Affordable Auckland model.
Well, can you explain the intricate details of the Affordable Auckland model so the listeners can get a decent idea of it?
Right. Well, I mean, obviously I've spent, you know, the last decade trying to advance extreme libertarianism. And that's gone down like a cup of cold vomit. People aren't buying it, and hey, fair enough. So if you want to achieve any sort of change in politics, you need to be able to take the people with you, and you need to offer them something that they can actually buy into, and they're not going to do that with libertarianism, so, you know, let's stop doing that. So Affordable Auckland's about trying to pick your battles you can win and pick goals which you can take the voters along with you. We chose a 5-point program of cutting rates, cutting spending, eliminating borrowing, protecting private property rights, and getting rid of the urban boundary, etc., so people can do what they want with their own properties, and affordable housing, which the first four lead up to the five, really. And we've found we got a lot of good feedback from that and quite a bit of support. So we've shown that picking our battles and picking things that we can take the public along with us is actually a lot more beneficial.
Can we go through the technical aspects of how you would actually achieve each step of that plan? So the first thing was what, cutting rates?
Yep, and that's quite a lofty idea, especially when you consider the percentage of revenue the council gets from borrowing is actually the same percentage of revenue that the council gets from rates. So that's actually quite disturbing, and you're wondering, well, where can you cut? The council needs to come back to its core function, so it needs to focus on getting rid of the stormwater, picking up the rubbish, maintaining the footpaths, libraries, things like that. I don't think it should be funding festivals, etc. We've got, for example, $3,000 spent on skateboard ambassadors during a previous school holiday. Skateboarders to go around and tell other skateboarders how to behave. What a waste of money. We've got the tram system around Wynyard Quarter. $16 million has been sunk into that now. They're not even running at the moment. It's costing $70,000 a year to rent those trams off an Australian company. I mean, that's not core functions of council. Let's focus on the essentials and the must-haves, and then when we've got our books in order, when we're not charging exorbitant rates, maybe then we can look at the nice-to-haves.
Now, Penelope Bright has gone to, I think, a Transparency International conference one time, and they have, I think, published publicly that the root cause of corruption is privatisation. And how are almost all council services currently done, but with public-private partnerships and contracting out and what have you? So I see a big discrepancy there between running an efficient city with low rates and employing all of these people contracted out. Then there's accountants and so on and so forth, this whole mix of things, plus there's the corruption possibility. Now, apparently apparently, back in the day before these first rounds of amalgamations, people were not only paying very low rates, but on occasions were even getting rate rebates under the borough council model. Allegedly, one person per street would be responsible for that street in terms of knowing the neighbours and the people on the street, any problems, trees and what have you. They'd call the council worker, guy in a council truck comes out, clean it up. And as a result, they had a very, very well tight-knit community, as well as a local government with a real voice for them. Whereas what's happening now with the super city, it's almost like, if I didn't know anybody, I'd say it's a deliberate attempt to ensure that people don't have any voice.
Well, one of the root causes of corruption, of course, are public-private partnerships, because it then gives the capacity for councillors and the people working for the council to be bought off. I wouldn't say that that's a problem with privatisation, however. Privatisation itself, I think, is a positive thing, because private companies, motivated by the profit motive, have a real, genuine reason to satisfy customers, whereas people working for a public service, every time, oh, we want a tree cut down or our drains are blocked, it's just more work to them. There's no incentive if they sort out these problems really efficiently. They still just take home their meagre salary each week. So I think the profit motive and further privatisation is actually would be a positive thing for the city. Unfortunately, we're hamstrung by current local government laws which actually mandate councils must do these things, so the change really can't happen at the local level.
Well, how exactly do they mandate that the council must do these things?
It's all under the Local Government Act, so there's sections in the Local Government Act which specifically say the council must do parks, it must do libraries, it must do stormwater.
Okay.
So if they're going to do it with the private sector, it can only be done through contracting out.
Okay. And do you believe anything should be done in-house, or the entire city should be privatised, every single service?
I don't think every single service should be privatised. Obviously, things like parks, it's very difficult to make a profit out of those. So I'm not advocating whole-scale, widespread, 100% privatisation of the city. I think that's a bit silly, but things, for example, Second Harbour Crossing, why don't we get a private company to do it? The good thing about that is that, number one, the ratepayer pays nothing. They only pay if they use it. And number two, there is no financial risk for the council whatsoever. The company doing the work carries the risk itself. So if costs overrun or it doesn't quite work out, the ratepayer has no penalty at all. It's all on that private owner.
Well, I think what you've touched on here is something that's very important to notice between the difference between privatisation and public-private partnerships. Public-private partnerships are privatisation, in my opinion, much like partial pregnancy. You know, there's no such Petty would say. But what happens is if you've got a private company, that private company takes private personal responsibility, individual responsibility, in a word. Whereas if it's a partnership, that means it doesn't matter what the company does, it virtually never bears any liability, and it winds up just getting bailed out by everybody else's rates, who don't really get to vote on the issue, just their representatives.
Absolutely. That's why I'm not a big fan of public-private partnerships. They're probably a step better than complete public works, because that puts all the burden on the ratepayer. But ultimately, I think we should be getting private companies to do as much of these things as possible.
As long as we can weed out the corruption and increase the responsibility of those corporations as they're doing it at the same time, because obviously they're going to be doing something really for the public benefit in a lot of ways, despite the fact that there's a profit margin. Now, I don't know about you, but I make a living off of serving the public, and I actually do receive money for that. So I've got no problems with people doing the right thing and getting paid for it. What I really am concerned about is when people are doing a terrible job and get bailed out for it and don't have to bear any responsibility for the crap job that they're doing.
That's right, and that's not capitalism. I've worked in the supermarket industry for 15 years. I do my job so that I get paid. You know, that's my profit motive. But it also means that people get their meat, they get their canned veggies, whatever it is they want. I'm not doing it because I want those people to get canned veggies. I just want to make my money, but that's how I do it, by serving the public.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so we've touched on that reduction in the rates issues. What's the next stage of the plan?
Spending.
How exactly are you going to rein in spending?
again, it comes down to core council functions that can only be done by the council. So let's focus on the stormwater, let's focus on the roads, the parks, the libraries, and let's stop trying to have all these nice-to-haves. I mean, we've got neighbourhood barbecues being held by some local boards to promote neighbourly get-togethers. I mean, people can do this if they want to. If they want to get to know their neighbours, let them do it.
Yeah.
But council and local boards certainly shouldn't be funding those sorts of things. So we really need to be tight on the purse strings. We need to say, is this a function that only the council can do? If it is, great, that's council business. But if it's something that people can do through voluntary cooperation or the private sector trying to make a profit, something like that, then so be it. I understand that, I'm not sure if the council funds the gay pride parade. I saw something in the Herald today saying that they were backing it. As much as I love the gay pride parade, I don't think it's something that should be funded by the council. Lantern Festival, I'm going along next weekend, I'm sure it'll be lots of fun, but I don't think it should be funded by the council. Private voluntary organisations are more than capable of doing this, and we need to get away from the idea that, oh, if the government doesn't do it, it won't happen. The government, Jamie White pointed out very well that the government doesn't produce shoes, but it still happens, so.
Well, there's another element that we touched on there that's quite important, is that if a government is overly protective and overly providing for a community, they don't actually help the community, they wind up hamstringing and destroying it, and indeed almost eliminate voluntarism.
Yeah. Let's have a look at state social welfare. You'll often see on the news people are outraged because food banks are helping more people than ever. I actually think that's a great thing. I think it's great if our voluntary charity sector is doing more than ever. I think that's the way that we should be helping people as much as possible. Obviously, I don't support eliminating the welfare state. I think there should be a safety net for our most vulnerable. But as much as possible, let's help them voluntarily. Do I personally contribute a hell of a lot in charity? I donate to a few small things, but the socialist definition of charity is probably my taxes, and I do pay a lot of those. But imagine how much I would be able to afford to help people voluntarily if I wasn't spending thousands and thousands on a public welfare system.
Now, let's say, for instance, you wanted to fund a project, I don't know, like the building of a school, for example, and you go out to the community and you go, right, who's a carpenter? Right, who owns a such and such wood manufacturer or whatever, who can provide building materials, who can provide labour, who can provide expertise, planning, and so on and so forth. And it gets to the point where you can actually make a school on the cheap and have the community actually be responsible for it.
Yep.
And as a result, when people build something themselves with their own hands, they tend to be protecting of that thing that they've just built.
That's right.
Whereas I find what's happening a lot of the times with the government in terms of what people are doing nowadays is they allow somebody else to come in, do it, bear no responsibility themselves, drop their kids off, and then that's it. And I've been saying on my radio show for a while now is that community is about as important to the human body as vitamin C is. You can't produce it on your own, and you need it every day.
Yep.
And at the moment, we're suffering a form of community scurvy. Partly because of the socialist policy of the way the city's being run, and indeed the way the world's being run to a large degree. I mean, look at America. Oh, it's a capitalist society. No, it's not. No, it gives bank a bailout. It's the worst form of communism I know.
Yeah. And you could take an example of the housing projects that they have in the US. Some of them end up getting knocked down because they're so vandalised, they're so poorly taken care of. The tenants in there bear no responsibility for it, they don't own it, and they trash it. And it's not the same as when you have private property or, you know, a community-based school where everyone's had a hand in building it. They've actually got a bit of self-interest in preserving it and making it run as well as possible.
Well, could we in some way instill that in Auckland, and precisely how would we actually go about that? How are we capable of rolling back the bureaucracy and the public spending and the borrowing and lowering the rates and everything like that at the same time as building a better community? Would it happen by osmosis, or does it actually need to be planned and facilitated properly?
You do initially need a cultural cultural change, you need people to recognise that the government can't do everything. It tries, it doesn't do a very good job. They need to recognise that perhaps they need to do some things for themselves. And until you have that cultural change, you're not going to see any change at the council. A way of identifying when that change has happened, I suppose, is when people like myself or people from Affordable Auckland eventually get elected. That might be a way of showing that that cultural change is occurring, but until then, it's not going to happen.
Now, the problem comes with, of course, getting yourself elected to a platform across a city of 1.4 million people, now? Including the fact that we have an enormous migrant population here as well, many of which don't even speak English, and also, on top of that, you have a voter turnout that's so low, it's almost insignificant.
40% last time in Auckland. Horrible.
well, it maybe the type of people that vote are the same people that have been voting the whole time in the first place, and I think they're the people who believe in the same policies that have got us into this very big problem area with their unitary plan, the massive budget blowouts, and the election of a corrupted mayor.
Yeah. Well, they're the people who are voting are probably the ones who think that the government can fix their problems, so they're trying to tell them how they want the problems fixed.
Well, see, and that's another thing. What's worse, somebody who votes and doesn't do anything for their community, or somebody who does heaps for their community and doesn't vote?
Oh, definitely the person who votes. It's interesting. You see, I know that they had some campaign in the States last presidential election to get everyone out to vote. I think it was called Rock the Vote or something trying to get young people to vote. I don't think that's necessarily a good thing. If people are not interested in politics, don't encourage them to vote. Just get the people who really care about getting things done and have actually made the effort to inform themselves to vote.
Well, that's actually another problem as well, is the voting public is not informed. Even the ones that do vote are not informed. And it's very clear, considering the policies, regardless of whether you vote for the left or the right, don't seem to actually change all that much. And yet, incidentally, every time a new government is elected, they're elected platforming on change.
Well, I mean, we take the national government, all the things that Labor did and they opposed, such as working for families, zero interest on student loans, etc., they've kept. I am a national member. I joined a couple of months ago, but you know, the National Party's a broad church. So I don't agree with everything they do, but it is disappointing to see that every time Labor increases the size of the state, National does very little to roll that back.
My opinion is that there is very little difference between these two major parties, and what they've done is it's called full spectrum dominance. So you tell people who are of one persuasion one thing, and another people who are of another persuasion another thing, whereas both parties that are campaigning on those two very different platforms actually wind up accomplishing the same goal once elected. Much like Vladimir Lenin said, is don't worry, comrades, we're just telling the people what they want to hear, and once we get given the power, then we do what we want.
Well, I mean, they're fighting each other for the centre ground, because I suppose that's where all the votes are, but then they end up being exactly the same thing. And it's the case in just about every two-party system that you see across the world, United States, Britain. I mean, in the US, we see the Republicans. I mean, spending over there, I saw a great cartoon today. Elephant and the arse are in a big pool of water. There's water gushing out of the tap. The elephant says, we need to reduce it by 2 drops. The arse goes, no, that's draconian. We need to reduce it by 1 drop. So.
It doesn't make sense. Unless, of course, you take into account the internationalists and the money power elite, essentially, that are doing all the donations and what have you. I mean, I sent a message to the National Party website one time asking for a list of their donors. They're supposed to publicly publish a list of donors that do over $10,000. There wasn't one. Yeah, who's financing these parties?
Actually, that's interesting you bring that up. I put out a press release about a week or so ago about Len Brown. $270,000 he was donated. I think it's called the New Council Trust. And I put something out saying, well, you know, who are these people? They've donated about three quarters of your campaign funding. No idea who they are. And I would have thought a Labour Party member would be the first to put his hand up for transparency.
Well, I would disagree. That you know, it's more the fact that if you're funded by dirty money, it means you just take the money, more or less, you know, because otherwise you won't get elected. It's like they'll just go to the next guy. It's like, okay, well, you won't take our bribe, we'll just bribe your competition and you'll be left out in the cold.
And this donation's gone completely under the radar. The media's not interested in it. Maybe I need to bang away about it a bit more. But
well, can you go into it a bit more? Do you know any more details about it?
I don't know too much details about it, but it is on his electoral return, which you can find on the Auckland Council website.
Mm-hmm.
New Council Trust, $270,000-something. That's all I know. I probably should make an Official Information Act request over it, because there's something suspect going on there.
Something, well, my little suspicion mode, as a conspiracy theorist, of course, goes up when you see something like that, and what occurs to me is the Committee for Auckland is the controllers of Auckland City, and because they're a private corporation that you have to pay something like $10,000 a year for membership.
Wow.
And you wind up having all of these massive banks, private contractors, and things of that nature, all part of this quote-unquote Committee for Auckland, who write the recommendations that the council winds up implementing. So, and incidentally, guess who gets awarded all the contracts?
Members of the committee.
All right. So you know, we've got a corporatocracy running the city, and I think that's actually the main point. So when you tell me that there's a huge donation coming in to Len Brown from a unknown organisation that requires an Official Information Act request in order to find out who the frack the buggers are, something tells me that the Committee for Auckland members are involved in that.
Yeah, well, surely it's not within the spirit of the I mean, I don't support the Electoral Finance Act, but surely it's not within the spirit of the law to have this $270,000 donation from a trust.
Well, what does this trust want? What do they want in return? I mean, it turns out in the United States, somebody did a study that it costs something like $30 million a year to bribe Congress and the Senate. For which they can get billions and billions of dollars in private contracts handed out to them, whether that be defence funding or public contracts or what have you. So if we've got a corporate takeover, this is the thing that I was thinking about privatisation yesterday, in fact, is that it swings from a spectrum. From one side, you have private companies that have, let's say, entrepreneurs at their heads, moral, ethical people want to serve the community. And on the other hand, you have private corporations, limited liability companies, who don't really have anybody at their head who really created it and founded it and is running everything and taking personal responsibility for what the company is doing. And they're much too large to really rein in terms of a government inquiry. It costs too much. And, you know, we don't want to threaten them because they might withdraw their bribes. And it turns into a corrupt mechanism. So I'm just wondering, I wonder at what size does a corporation become powerful enough to actually prevent itself from being accountable?
Well, the corporations and the bribery of Congress members is simply a symptom of the problem, though. The actual problem itself is that these government organisations have the power to dish out favours. Their functions are way beyond what was intended by the Founding Fathers when they wrote the US Constitution. The government's doing far more than it was ever meant to under that constitution, and so that leads to this future corruption. So we actually need to deal with the source of the problem, which is a government that does too much.
I think so, and it needs to be stepped back, and of course something has to step in to fill that void, and that's where voices in the community are supposed to come in. What's problematic, I found, is that they get ignored largely, you know. I mean, I see many community groups in South Auckland that are actually doing a really good job. They're they're reducing crime, they're reducing family violence, they're reducing homelessness through as simple things as being a finance company that doesn't charge recurring interest. You pay one fee on top of your loan, and then hey presto, you don't have any money worries. You don't beat your wife or your kids anymore. You know, it works like that. Yeah. And then of course the government comes in and tries to shut them down because you're just a bad person. And I was like,
you're exploiting the poor.
Yeah. It's really messed up. But it's only messed up to me because I'm not a sociopath. Yeah. I mean, if I was a psycho, for example, I'd look at the city and the way it's being run, and I'd be quite happy indeed to see what's happening to it. What kind of borrowing is Auckland City going under at the moment?
Well, we started off with a debt of $3.7 billion. That is now hitting the $7 billion mark. $1 billion was borrowed last year. $1.2 billion is being borrowed this year. There is no sign of it slowing down. There's no plan to stop borrowing. I'm getting pretty worried. We will be up to the $10 billion debt mark at the end of this council term if there's no change. And what? Then how do you reverse that and start paying it off?
Well, I think we should pull in Iceland and just go, look, your bank has made that money up, bro. There's nothing backing it. Just go home, all right?
Yeah, I probably wouldn't do that. I think if they've lent money, they do deserve to have it paid back.
Yeah.
But, I mean, our rates are high now, but with the borrowing levels we're doing, it's sentencing ratepayers of the future to guaranteed high rates. And how do we reverse that once you go too far? Something's got to be done about in the next 3 years. I mean, even by the next election, that's probably as late as we can do any real sort of change to it. Otherwise, you know, 10 years' time, we're in the shit.
Yeah, well, there's the deception value as well. For instance, the council says, we will not increase rates beyond the rate of inflation. And there's a clause in the council laws that allow them to make up their own rate of inflation.
I was not aware of that. Well, that's interesting. Yeah. And I mean, it has gone up over the rate of inflation every year. And Len Brown's been deliberately deceptive when he says an average 2.5% rate's increasing. That makes you sound like he's being fiscally responsible. But what we're finding is that the people in the old Auckland borough, which was actually run pretty fiscally responsibly, are facing 10% annual rate rises for the last 3 years, while people in Waitakere, which was a socialist basket case, are getting rates cuts. It seems so unfair that the people in the new super city are now getting penalised because their previous council was so responsible.
Seems like a similar policy to global warming taxes and what have you, doesn't it? Yeah. It's a transfer of wealth.
Yeah.
So are we going to see in Auckland in the future, if this process isn't stopped, a city in poverty, you know, Rio de Janeiro kind of thing, you know, we'll have to paint some of their houses bright colours so they don't look quite so bad?
My expectations at this stage are not optimistic, actually. and you also got to consider those, like, people in Iraqi, it is a pretty wealthy area, but a lot of those places are owned by pensioners on very limited incomes. A pensioner gets about, $400 a week, if they're lucky. How can they afford a rates rise? And those houses are worth, you know, over $1 million. Every rates rise is another step towards them being pushed out of their house and becoming dependent.
And foreclosed on, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
In fact, I was talking to a friend of mine, Evelyn Gilbert, who lives down in Raglan, and she lives in a beach community, and their rates have gone staggeringly up, and there's actually quite a lot of people who retired in, like, the 80s, the 90s, and they now have to move into a retirement home because they literally can't afford to keep their home because the rates are too high.
Yep.
I think that's freaking disgusting. It's despicable. How can you do that to people?
They're turning the rich into the poor.
Yeah. Well, I think they're just turning the middle class into the poor. And what I've noticed in speaking about how societies get run is the only way there's any kind of fairness or equity in a society is if if there's actually fairness in the equity, full stop. You know, if you have a lower class, a middle class, and an upper class, you have a middle class that has enough money to spend enough time on politics, studying stuff, be educated and whatnot, to hold the more powerful at bay and to help the poorer people up. Whereas if you only have the super poor and the super rich, you've got no equity whatsoever, no equality, no rights.
Though we also have to get away from the tendency of the left to focus on equality, because sometimes I think they'll be happy if everyone's equally poor.
Yeah, exactly. And here's the thing about pulling people up from their bootstraps. You don't pull them up from their bootstraps, they have to pull themselves up.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Otherwise you create dependency.
Exactly. I mean, if you have a prison, for instance, and you feed your inmates every day and you house them and everything like that, and you say, oh, we've got these guards here to keep you safe, you know, from the other prisoners, you're still living in a freaking prison, and it still costs like $26,000 a year or something of that nature just to put you through a quit smoking program.
Yeah. Shouldn't be that hard to quit smoking in a prison these days, I wouldn't think.
Apparently it's rather easy. In fact, I interviewed Dr. Green from the Dactory about this, and he goes, it was the best quit smoking program I ever participated in. Only cost the taxpayers $26,000 to make me stop smoking after all these years, you know? Yeah. And that's what happens, you know? It's like, if you have a spoiled brat who expects everything to be given to them and what have you find after a very short period of time that they keep asking for more and more until you realise one day that these people are more trouble than they're frickin' worth because they don't know how to take care of themselves.
Yep, very true.
That's what we're ending up with. We're ending up with an entire city, an entire society incapable of taking care of themselves. People don't know how to grow their food. I think also one thing would be really great is if people actually started collecting the rainwater off of their roofs to reduce the amount of dependency on water care services and all of that kind of stuff. If we could just gradually take this city down to a level where it's actually kind of fair, people have got enough money, they're not paying too much rates, they can actually afford to live where they're living, and they have accountable council that actually do what they say they're going to do, who actually get brought up on charges if they commit crimes, who actually stop companies being involved with the council if they're proven to be corrupt and or bribing councillors. At the moment, it's virtually the opposite to everything that I've said. Virtually the opposite to everything you and an affordable Auckland want.
Definitely.
How is the public receiving this, though? Because I'm aware of the situation, at least to an extent. It seems that the vast majority of the public are either part of the 40% who have no idea whatever, and they still vote anyway, or 60% who have no idea and don't care.
Well, I mean, we still have some very hardcore socialist rumps throughout the super city who tend to do most of the voting, I think. South Auckland's always been Labour territory. My experience is when I was in West Auckland and got booed off a couple of stages, also very similar. Then you've got areas in the North Shore, Rodney, Franklin, which voted the other way. But yeah, there's definitely still a wide-scale mindset of the council can do it for me, and therefore I'm not doing it for myself.
It reminds me of the Simpsons episode when Homer didn't want to take the trash out, and so he had this big massive pile of trash in his front yard, and the trash people wouldn't take it because he was really rude to them and what have you. So he runs for mayor of Springfield, and he winds up getting elected on a platform of, can't someone else do it?
I remember that. It was a great episode.
Yeah. And, how much for those suede shoes for the trash collectors? Yeah, that'll be good. And he blows the whole town's budget. And, just like nowadays, it's almost like we really have to shovel medical waste into the bloody town's mineshaft in order to keep the the coffers full of money. Yeah. You know, we're contaminating the whole frickin' city with this crap. Here's another thing. Speaking of contamination, what's your stance on roadside spraying with cancer-causing Roundup and whatnot?
It's not something I've looked into, actually, so I wouldn't want to make too much comment on it. It does kind of remind me of the booms issue, though. I mean, you would think being being on the right, that I would be anti the mowing of the berms, but I actually think it's council property. The council should do it. And so the council certainly should be maintaining those in an appropriate fashion, and I think getting rid of weeds is probably something they should be doing. I don't know all the intricacies of Roundup, so I couldn't comment on specifically what they're using, but I certainly think they should be maintaining those areas.
I agree so as well. It really shouldn't be the responsibilities of the residents to maintain council property for them, considering they're already paying their rapes. Freudian slip. And what I found really kind of disturbing about this is that looking into Roundup, I mean, first of all, it's made by Monsanto. There's your first warning sign, you know. Who made Agent Orange? Monsanto.
Yeah.
And didn't they say that was safe? Oh, yes, they did. Didn't they say Roundup was biodegradable? Oh, yes, they did. Doesn't it cause cancer, though, and is not biodegradable? Oh, yes, it is.
Oh, okay.
And what we've got now, I think, all of that stuff goes into the stormwater, winds up going into the sea and what have you. And my missus has been using a pine oil organic spray that is actually working far more powerfully than Roundup now, and doesn't contaminate the environment, doesn't have massive levels of glyphosate and all of these other chemicals and what have you in it. And it occurs to me that we've got so many issues of contamination within the city. You know, we've got, let's say, we've got fluoride in the water, for example, which is listed as a contaminant. It's a heavy toxin. And that goes down your drain, because we don't drink most of our water, do we? And the only way fluoride can actually be returned to the environment without causing environmental degradation is if it's filtered through human kidneys. So what we're doing is we're paying for an additive into the water supply that contaminates the water supply and the people drinking it and anything that they water their garden with and what have you.
I should probably state my position on fluoride before we continue.
Go for your life, son.
My personal position on it is I think it's safe and I have no issue with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, water's a publicly supplied good, so I would definitely be okay with having a referendum on the issue. I think seeing, you know, the entire public uses it, they should get a say on whether it's added or not. So I'm
What's your stance on forced medication?
Yeah, well, see, that's essentially what it is, so that's why I'd support a referendum on it.
Yeah, because I think that's basically what it comes down to. People have the right to refuse medication if they don't want it, and if you purposely put it into a water supply, you can't really escape from it. You shower in it, you drink it, you cook your food in it, that kind of thing. And it's actually almost prohibitively expensive to buy fluoride filters. You need I think it's a half micron thick filter sheet in order to get it out, which is the same thickness required to filter out uranium from water.
So that's why I support the referendum.
Yeah. But of course, that didn't work out too well for Hamilton. The people voted, or rather the councillors voted, to get the fluoride out of the water supply. And that was because we had doctors, dentists, and health professionals, MDs, and what have you, able to speak to the councillors.
Mm.
And because some of the councillors were on the district health board, who had public health policy stating that they have to support fluoride no matter what, they had to recuse themselves because it's a biased vote. Mm. And so as a result of those biased voters being voted out of the room, then 6 out of the 7 remaining councillors voted to get fluoride out.
Mm.
And then, Professor Paul Connett predicted, there would be a huge media defamation campaign against all those councillors in order to attack them and into reversing the policy and what have you. And then a public referendum was called out. The local district health board spent $48,000 on a public campaign to convince people that anybody who says that fluoride was bad for you was insane.
A disturbing use of public money.
I think so. But that's the only reason I believe that fluoride is even in our water at the moment, is because people are using public monies to brainwash the public into accepting it without looking at any of the facts, as these councillors did. I mean, if you elected somebody and you trust trusted them enough to actually give them your vote and elect them, and they put through a policy, for example, like removing fluoride from the water, regardless of your belief, shouldn't you? I don't know really where I'm getting at here. It's just more the fact that I really don't want to be force medicated, and it really F's me off when people get their own taxpayer money put into a coffer to convince them of something that has no actual scientific evidence behind it.
Well, whatever your thoughts on fluoride, I don't think public money should be spent on promoting it or dissing it in any way.
Now, let's take it back to individual responsibility. If you wanted fluoride, there are sacks of fluoride with skull and crossbones that are in perfect powder that have cadmium and iron and all sorts of other wonderful good chemicals for you and what have you that they get out of the phosphate fertilizer industry in China that we fluoridate our water with. So if you want fluoridated water, just buy one of these level 6 biotoxin sacks of fluoride and wear a hazmat suit when you put a teaspoon of it into your water when you drink it every day. It should be fine, you know. You can take personal responsibility for your own contamination rather than making it forced on everybody else. And I think that's really what it comes down to. It's forcing a choice, and I don't like to have any choices forced upon me. You know what I'm saying?
I guess that's always the moral hazard of public goods, isn't it?
Well, and again, if we have a look at public goods, I've seen almost the. The opposite is true in every single case. This is going to be really good for you because such and such, and it turns out later on upon study there's actually really bad for you because of such and such a reason. Like you take the medical industry, for example. My brother's a chiropractor and he's working in Tahiti now. And I think 2 weeks ago when I was having my wedding, he was over here and we had a look at, or at least he was telling me about a new study that came out of the United States studying the deaths caused by accidents in the American medical system. It used to be previously thought that every 60 seconds there would be one person. So it winds up being about maybe 25, 26,000 people a year. But it turns out it's actually 7 people every minute and winds up going, or something like that, and about maybe 400,000 a year.
Wow.
Which is the leading killer in the United States. And that's just accidents. That doesn't include people who die because they've been given chemo or die because of medications that weren't good for them and so on and so forth. Just accidents. If you add on the other things, it's so much the number one killer. The public health sector in America is its number one killer. And even the Ministry of Health in New Zealand publishes similar statistics in 2006. They said just accidents caused in New Zealand by biomedical things, you know, like they'll sew somebody up with accidentally a pair of scissors still inside them or something like that, and they'll die from that. Third leading cause of death in New Zealand doesn't include vaccine reactions or anything like that. And so my thought is, if it comes from an official source, assume for a moment that it's the exact opposite of whatever they're stating it is.
Well, we have to keep in mind that every medication that's been recalled by the Food and Drug Administration was first approved by the Food and Drug Administration.
And incidentally, the pharmaceutical companies who were producing that medication incidentally have people that they donate to that are on the boards of the FDA and used to work for them as their CEO or something, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
In some cases, with up to 14 financial connections to the pharmaceutical industry is what I've seen published in some manuals. And it's quite, you just have to look. As soon as you look, that's when you start seeing the problems. And I think that people don't see the problem with fluoride public health policy or local council and accountability in government and the overcosting and the overzealous nature of roading and what have you, because they just haven't looked. And I think it's because shows like mine aren't very well received because the truth is offensive. Really? I mean, wouldn't you agree that's kind of half the reason why you might have gotten booed off stage, because you were telling the truth and people just get offended by it?
Yes, well, I can tell you, telling people that if they want to preserve heritage they should do it themselves is not very popular out in Waitakere. And they definitely love their liquor licensing trusts out there. Someone asked a question, what were we going to do about them? And I got straight up and said, I'll abolish them straight away.
Yeah.
Yeah. don't do that in Waitakere.
Yeah. What's your problem with the Liquor Licensing Trust?
It's a coercive monopoly. I don't think they should have that power to control alcohol sales. I think alcohol sales should be up to... leave it up to the market. Let people build their liquor store and, you know, they succeed or fail on their own. It's interesting, anti-alcohol campaigners will like to try and limit the number of liquor stores. That doesn't actually reduce liquor-related harm. It just entrenches the profits of the existing stores. Their competition's being wiped out by all these anti-liquor crusaders. Whereas if you had a high concentration of liquor stores in a particular area, it's not going to grow the amount of money being spent on alcohol. They're just going to eat into each other's profit margins. And, you know, some of them will end up closing because they'll be unsustainable. So all this interference is actually just making the existing owners richer.
Now, is it making the alcohol problem worse or better, I wonder? I mean, statistically speaking, you know, how many incidents of arrests for drunk and disorderly behaviour has West Auckland been reduced since establishing the Portage Licensing Trust for the sale of liquor in West Auckland, or has it gone through the roof?
I haven't had a look at those figures, so it would be unfair for me to comment, but I recall putting up election signs about midnight last year, and there is a heavy police presence around the town areas, for example, Henderson, etc., so I wonder if it's really having an impact.
What concerns me is also, I think, local government getting involved in people's drug consumption. You know, alcohol's a drug. We all know it is. It's a very dangerous drug too, and certain people just can't handle it, and they go out of control. They get violent and obnoxious, and it's really annoying. I think Bill Hicks said you can tell a lot about society by the drugs that it uses, and our society uses coffee 5 days a week to keep you awake so that you can work at your slave job and work efficiently, and then alcohol during the weekend so you can forget that you're a slave for a moment.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't support the new laws that have come in over liquor. I think it's an issue of individual responsibility. It's an issue of cultural change. Laws aren't going to change the fact that people like to binge and get wasted.
Yeah.
They're just going to do it within a smaller time frame. The council does have the power to set local alcohol policies that are around, you know, the 4 o'clock closing time we have now. I advocate opening it back up to the 24-hour licences. I don't think because of a few people's irresponsibility, everyone else should be penalised. People should be free to enjoy it responsibly without those restrictions, I think.
I think so too, because I had my stag night a couple of weeks ago, bro, and at 11:06 we were like, all right, let's go get us a box of beer and then we'll go have a drink somewhere, it'll be fun, rather than paying $10 per beer at a bar. Turns out, through the liquor licensing everywhere, all the supermarkets stopped selling their beer at 11 o'clock.
Yes.
Damn it! It was the worst stag night ever.
And interestingly, it means that instead of you getting pissed at home, maybe you'll have too much, maybe it won't be a good experience, but at least you're having it at home instead of going out to town and then causing trouble.
Yeah. And it just kind of got to the point where I was like, I'm really, really sick of having my choices restricted by somebody else. I mean, if I'm not hurting anybody, and if I'm not damaging anybody's property, and if I'm taking personal responsibility for my behaviour, nobody should be able to tell me what I can and can't do.
Yep.
Right?
And I get really grumpy. Your local suburban newspaper, every couple of weeks you'll see a group of neighbours are all standing like this in front of their house or in front of a liquor store. Community says no to the liquor store. I don't think they should have that right.
Yeah.
And, you know, they could say no, they cannot patronise it, but I don't think they should be able to use the law to stop that liquor store being in place. What I do like is an experiment that they're doing in the UK with private holding tanks for people. If they get too drunk, the police throw them into the holding private tank until they sober up, and then the company charges them for their care. I think that's a good way to instill some sort of responsibility.
Well, I remember when I was in high school in Waiheke, and we had a Spanish exchange student, and we were 18, it was seventh form year, and we're always going out and getting drinking on the weekends, you know, as you do in high school when you're able to buy liquor. And what I found was the Spanish guy never got too pissed. And we were curious about this. We asked him, you know, why is this? Why have you got kind of, you know, you're drinking under control. It doesn't really matter what you're drinking, whether it's wine or spirits or beer. You kind of tend to be able to control yourself. Mm. And he says, well, in Basque country, man, we just drink wine from the age of like 6 or 7 or whatever, you know, one with dinner, and it becomes part of the culture. It's an everyday thing. Nobody goes out of control. And once you've got a drinking culture that isn't self-destructive, and it's actually there with a almost a responsible to not drink too much, because you drink all the time anyway and you don't really need to, that's when the culture changes. And we have seen a dramatic decrease in the amount of alcohol-related violence and injuries and car accidents and what have you as a result of these really quite massive campaigns against drink driving and drunk violence and these things like that you see on the television ads all the time. You know, like,
and that's creating a cultural change. It's not through extra regulation.
Yeah, but however, it is using taxpayer money in order to finance the advertising rather than allowing the culture to develop on its own.
Yeah.
Which occurs to me is that people's culture is determined by what they see on TV.
I think that probably is.
Alright, which means that the community's just not there anymore. Okay, it's all very well talking about community spirit, but there ain't a community at all. To a large degree, people are all at home watching TV, don't know their neighbours.
Yeah.
All right. And I think I actually include myself in that. I mean, I don't watch TV anymore because I didn't bother getting a Freeview box or what have you. But I don't know my neighbours, and I don't think most people do. And it's pretty difficult to give a frack about your community if you don't even know that one exists.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a cultural change we can work on. My very special guest from Affordable Auckland is Stephen Berry, joining me for 3 hours, and we will be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, after we take a WikiLeak. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's now hour number 2 with my special guest, Stephen Berry. He's not related to Chuck Berry, although he does strum a good tune under an old willow tree. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Maybe that was a bad joke. Now, we were talking outside about Agenda 21, and you don't know a whole lot about it. In fact, I have a book over here called Behind the Green Mask. This is written by a woman named Rosa Corey, and basically what we've found is there's this green agenda, okay, you know, basically, you know how Greenpeace started up, it was about environmental issues and so on and so forth, and they split out, and one of the main founders started up Sea Shepherd, and the reason why he split apart from Greenpeace, which he actually began, was because they were being taken over by communists.
Yep.
Now, do you see a similar agenda being at play here, how Auckland's talking about sustainability and this draft unitary plan and all of that kind of stuff? I see it just basically as sort of like an everything-ism, socialism type of experiment.
That's absolutely what it is. And when we look at the policies of the Green Party, their environmental aims, you know, that's great. We should be looking after the environment. But every single proposal the Green Party puts forward to protect the environment is about control. We want to tax you, we want to regulate you, we want to ban things. It's all about control.
So that's basically what the draft unitary plan would wind up accomplishing, don't you think?
Absolutely. You know, I support private property rights. I want people to be able to do what they want on their property as long as it doesn't violate other people's property rights. So you're not going to see a system where you have a 20-storey apartment right next to a one-storey residential home, because that's obviously going to violate your neighbour's property rights. But as much as possible, people should just be doing what they want with their own land. Mm. And the Unitary Plan very specifically sets out exactly what you can do on your own land, to the point where it's not really even worth owning property. I mean, I rent currently, so my landlord tells me what I can do with the house, and that's fine. But if I went and bought a house, I'd just have the council telling me what I can do with it.
Mm. Well, can you explain exactly how the Unitary Plan is supposed to be working?
Well, it will set areas like the...
I understand that that's a broad question.
It is, yeah.
So maybe we can start off on explaining some elements of it. I mean, first of all, define what is a unitary plan.
A unitary plan sets out specific zones throughout the city where you can do certain functions with your property. So inside the inner city, you're allowed to build high apartments, and it's actually forced intensification. In the outer suburbs, it's forced sprawl. So... there will be areas where you can only have one or two stories. There will be other areas where you can build up to three stories. And I don't think we need that sort of plan. I think we need people making their own decisions about their property. When you have a plan like this, the compliance with the plan drives up property prices, because there's so many regulatory hoops to jump through. It drives up the cost of construction incredibly. Which
filters down to the renters.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, the people who are renting are often lower-income people, so it's just actually making the poor poorer. Mm. And another example would be the urban boundary, which dictates you can only build residential housing within this boundary. What do you think happens to the prices when you artificially cut off supply? They go up. I mean, that's basic fifth-form economics. We saw those graphs when we went to high school, so why the hell isn't the council getting this?
Well, maybe they're doing it intentionally. the question is, who benefits?
Well, property developers, I suppose. I'll take that back, actually, because I think property developers would benefit more if they were able to build wider and build freer.
Now, here's one part of the Agenda 21 clause, is the propensity for the domination of public-private partnerships. This is how they plan to bring the entire world under corporate control, is through step-by-step public-private partnerships. And also public-private partnership recipients, like companies and so on and so forth, will be immune from prosecution for any dodgy buildings and things of that nature. For example, if you were part of a government-mandated company and you built a whole bunch of leaky homes, and people tried to come after you for building all those leaky homes and ruining their lives and their finances and all of that kind of stuff, you wouldn't be able to do anything because they're a recipient.
Yep.
Right? Practical immunity. So again, it creates this disparity, and as I was speaking about before, it's going to have the super poor and the super rich, and only them, and it'll eventually wipe out the middle class, which, in my opinion, if you don't have a middle class, you don't have freedoms.
Mm. And we also have to remember, with our own leaky home crisis in Auckland, all those homes were signed off by the council as being safe. The council must take a lot of responsibility for that. Mm. Unfortunately, I don't know how we can afford to bail out the people who have been wronged by the council. It's a very difficult issue.
In Canada, they had a similar crisis, I believe, and what the local government did was it instantly paid off. This is how much we need our house to be repaired, so they instantly paid them off and allowed those people to repay back the council if they wound up getting any resolution with the companies, which they did. So at least this way, they have their home, not a leaky building, and it's all fixed and everything like that, and then they can worry about the other things, rather than what's happening in New Zealand at the moment, where you've got a leaky home, you either have enough money to fix it or you don't, and you're screwed and you'll never get any compensation.
Yeah, that sounds pretty fair. I mean, seeing as the council signed these things off, they must take responsibility for it.
But again, who are they taking all that money off in order to compensate for their own incompetence? Yeah, they're taking it off everybody else.
That's right.
And it comes back to passing the buck and this bailout kind of mentality that we've got here. This is just terrible.
Yep, and what really should be happening is that the companies that have screwed up these houses should be paying the cost for it. But, of course, the council does wear a lot of responsibility for signing them off.
Well, how exactly do you make accountable government in that, say, like, for example, Penny Boat is a mayoral candidate, you know, you ran against her in the election, and she wanted to create a division of council specifically to protect whistleblowers from council-controlled organisations, private contractors, and what have you. So if anything corrupt or any misappropriation of funds, bribery, lack of accountability and what have you was going on, that the council would actually provide a framework by which those people could come forth and indeed wind up bringing these people to justice.
I would have to look at the details of that closer to make a proper comment on it. My initial instinct is always to oppose yet another council body. I think we have quite enough of them, and we also have a court system which works perfectly well, but I'd be willing to have a look at it.
I'd completely disagree about the court system working. We've got quite a lot of disparities in there, and of course I was just thinking about Len Brown in terms of if he cheats on his wife, for how long was it that he was...
2 years, so he can hardly claim it was one mistake. It was several mistakes.
Me love you a long time. And what if you're supposed to be the pinnacle of trustworthiness, a community man, and what have you, and then you pull something like this, you get the natural reaction from the public, which is what the protest is about. Step down, Len Brown.
Yep. I do want to make clear, the affair itself...
is inconsequential?
Him cheating on his wife, none of my business. I don't care what he does in his private life. However, when you shag on the desk at work, when you jerk off in your office, when you have sex in the Ngāti Whātua room, that crosses the line. If I had sex at work on my desk, got caught, job gone.
Yeah.
Instant.
Especially in the deli section.
Oh, no, he's got some meat on him.
No one would buy the sausages again, sir.
Apart from the woman that you're doing it to.
I mean, that is definitely unprofessional, and you should get fired for that.
In fact, anybody, anywhere, in any form of employment, having sex at work, or on your boss's property, or somebody else's property, or even taxpayer-funded property, and what have you, so that you can have a nice... I think I'll stop it right there. fired. Yep. Boom! Anybody can do that. But he's number one, isn't he?
Yep, and
who can fire the mayor?
There is no process to get rid of him. I think what they have in California, Wisconsin, probably a lot more US states, where there's the capacity for voters to hold referendums to recall their elected officials. I think that's a model that we should be using here.
Well, including binding referendums as well, because I'm quite sick constantly by the fact that we have people like the Labours and Greens and so on and so forth that go around and they do these massive collections of signatures and the public's like on board, no, we don't want the privatisation. You know, ideology aside, what the people want is what the people should probably get. You know, the will of the people is the basis of the authority of government, allegedly. And yet, it doesn't matter. At any point that there's ever been a referendum in this country, it has made zero difference to public policy.
I'm not actually a supporter of binding referendums. The national government did campaign on the partial privatisation of assets. They were elected with a resounding number of votes, 49% of the vote. I think they had a mandate to do that. The other issue I have with binding referendums is that things like individual rights, individual liberty, property rights, I don't think that should be up for a public vote. I don't think that your rights are dictated by the majority, and I don't think that 50.1% of the people should be able to tell 49.9% of the people what they can and can't do with their lives. So I do think binding referendum can actually be quite dangerous to individual liberty. But in the case of recall elections, well, that's what democracy is all about, so I think that's fine.
Well, and also there's the other thing. I mean, if you have a look at, say, some of the promises of John Key, and... can you name me one thing he's promised before an election that he went through with after the election and precisely the way he said he would do it?
He did go through with the private-public sorry, the partial privatisations. He did promise that. I mean, there's other cases, obviously. The GST, I think he was probably not completely upfront about that. And, I mean, while I am a National Party member, it's a broad church, I don't support everything they do. Overall, though, I do think he has been quite an effective Prime Minister, but I mean, there are the things I mentioned earlier where all these things Labour did, which they opposed while they're in opposition, they haven't rolled back in government, so that's definitely something for them to improve on.
And I don't think Labour's really any better. I mean, it was actually quite interesting. I found when David Shearer got taken over by David Cunliffe, then I compared Cunliffe and John Key. John Key's the MP of Helensville, which is in West Auckland, and he lives in Parnell, which is a swanky inner suburb. And then David Cunliffe is an MP in New Lynn, which is out west, but he lives in Herne Bay, which is a swanky inner suburb. John Key was educated overseas and spent most of his working life overseas working for international banks and what have you. And David Cunliffe was educated overseas and spent most of the time working for international organisations.
Yep.
I don't really see a difference.
Yeah.
All I see is globalism.
Mm.
I don't see any New Zealanders who are educated, born and raised, and have the community's best interests at heart, getting anywhere near the policy level.
Mm. Yep, definitely difficult, especially if you don't have the money. I mean, Brown spent, over $300,000 on his campaign. I spent $4,000, and that was all my own money.
Where did Brown get his cash from? From a trust.
Secret trust, yes.
From a secret trust. Could it not be more obvious? I mean, Transparency International calls New Zealand one of the first equal, I think, top three least corrupt countries in the world.
I'd hate to visit those other corrupt countries.
Well, what I found interesting is that one of these other top two least corrupt countries in the world was, I think, Finland, whose immigration policy allows for 500 people to immigrate every year. New Zealand, and that's at a population of, I think, between 10 and 14 million, I forget which. New Zealand allows 50,000 immigrants per year plus, and we only have a population of 4 million.
Mm.
So you have a rapid saturation of different cultures within our country, and I think that what that does is it actually breaks up community and destroys the local culture, because there's just not quite so much of it going around. It becomes multicultural.
Mm.
And when something's multicultural, trying to campaign on a platform to bring all those different cultures together becomes impossible. And so most people just don't vote, and whatever happens, happens.
Mm.
Right? There's no community participation. There's very little assimilation for the immigrant cultures that we have in this. We've got several suburbs in this city that are very, very ethnic in terms of, you know, a certain group of people from a certain nationality will live in, say, Howick, for example, has a large quantity of Chinese immigrants.
Yep.
And that's actually produced new immigrants parties and so on and so forth. We're actually changing the political and social dynamic at the same time that we're allowing new people to come into the country, and at the same time that we're, you know, first equal least corrupt country in the world, the other ones are like Singapore, which is run by one guy and his family, who are the heads of all the government departments. and when we get sent the Transparency International sends you a checklist, all right, like a forms to fill out, you know, has there been any corruption in your country? New Zealand goes, no, we're not filling anything out, sends it back, and so bang, we're the least corrupt. And, you know, it sounds funny, and it sounds crazy, but that's actually how it works. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, you have a look at all these international regulations and things, and it's just so one-eyed, one-sided. Everything in this country seems to be corrupt from the ground up.
It was interesting that the UN sent back 155 recommendations to our government on how to improve our human rights record. I don't know what those recommendations are. I would suspect a lot of them aren't actually human rights. They're more you have a right to something, which I don't particularly agree with, but it'd be interesting to see what's on that list.
Well, you have a right to not be killed by police officers for no good reason, I think, you know.
Yeah, yeah. That's a human right.
Considering there's been nearly 1,400 people killed by New Zealand police officers in the line of duty since the late 60s, and not one of those cops has ever gone to jail as a result, I think there's something we could do about that, you know. the police have been getting a bad rap recently, you know, like there were these rapists on YouTube and what have you, and they were reported to the police, and the police did nothing about them.
Yeah.
And then I think Martin Bradbury, I mean, make what you want of him, comes out and criticises them, and then he's going to be taken to court to either receive an exorbitant fine or a jail term for criticising the New Zealand police of a lack of action.
Oh, I saw he did that cartoon about better work stories, didn't he?
And what happens is, it occurs to me that that's really kind of not a good idea. I mean, we want to increase respect for the police by fining people and jailing them who criticise us.
Yeah, that's probably the wrong way to go.
How about this? Stop killing people! Stop killing people and ruthlessly beating people to death, you know? Maybe that would increase the amount of respect that you got. Perhaps, I don't know, you know, yeah. I'm not a sociologist, but I think that beating the shit out of people so that they die in the line of duty and then never getting fired, or maybe even if you do get fired, not going to jail for murder or grievous bodily harm or something like that, the same laws that the rest of us are supposed to be held towards, I think that decreases respect in the police, because it occurs to me that it means that the police don't have any respect for us.
Yeah, and let's not get it wrong. I mean, the majority of police do a fantastic job, and I think overall we do have a very professional police force, but there's always room for improvement.
Oh yeah, and they're hard to bribe in this country too.
Yeah. I mean, that's good or bad, depending on which side you're on.
That's actually one of the good stats about this country is, what was it? I think Bali, for example, if you get caught with some weed or some drugs there, you can actually just give a relatively small amount of money to the cop to look the other way. In New Zealand, it's actually, I think it's allegedly one of the hardest places in the world to bribe frontline police staff.
Well, they are paid pretty well too, so.
Allegedly. And in fact, I spoke to a, he might have been a detective, I think, and he was concerned that, I think this was back when I was a cannabis campaigner, and what he was saying to me was that we had these big signs that said, end the drug war, and he recommended that we change the sign to say, end the drug war, wipe out the gangs. And I was talking to him about this, and he says that when, even though he's a detective and he's getting paid more than regular police, he has to pay for his fuel and all of these other things, and he's got to pay his rent and his food, and it's actually quite difficult to survive even on a detective's wage.
No.
Now, I think professional policing is supposed to be about integrity and community spirit, mostly. When you're defending people from attackers and what have you, I think that's the highest calling for police, and they put themselves in harm's way a lot of the time. However, all too often we hear these horror stories where it is not the offender that has caused the violence, it is in fact the police who started it all along. And indeed, whenever you take these people to court, the police close ranks, much like a gang, and in fact refer to themselves as the largest gang in New Zealand, deny, unless there's video or audio evidence of them lying, and they get off. Now, that's really concerning to me, because, again, we're talking about this giant spectra of a lack of accountability, both within central government, local government, and indeed government departments in the whole. I mean, who do you complain to if the police do something bad to you? You complain to the police, Independent Police Conduct Authority, which is staffed exclusively by police, who are the biggest gang in the country, according to themselves.
Yeah, I can see some merit in not having the police involved in that process.
Yeah. I mean, a truly independent police commission against corruption of some description would actually be a much better thing than whatever we've got now. Perhaps it shouldn't even be staffed by police at all. You don't have that loyalty value. You need independence in order to actually critically analyse things that are truly happening, and in order to solve those problems without unflinching loyalty.
Yeah, agree with you there.
However, I believe that in order to maintain law and order in society, you need those who impose the law in order to abide by it themselves.
Yep.
And so, therefore, any kind of police corruption, police brutality, should be very swiftly dealt with.
Yeah, I mean, I still think overall we are quite lucky in this country to have what is overall a professional police department. I've seen many horror stories from the US where First, Second Amendment rights are frequently violated by the police. Alex Jones is very good at highlighting those. You see them all across YouTube. So we still are one of the lucky countries, I think, in regards to police professionalism. But yes, there are still, you know, unfortunate exceptions.
No, sometimes they're quite nasty. Like Paul Heinrich, for example, he was hogtied, naked, and beaten on the hour every hour for an entire weekend in in the Henderson police station without food or water.
Wow.
You know, you hear stories like that, and you actually have the testimony from these people who this has just blatant dehumanization, you know, actual torture methodology being employed on people in this country. It's just sick. It's just terrible. And you don't know how to do it. And I interviewed this former police prosecuting sergeant named Grace Hayden. She's now a private investigator. Prosecuting started for 15 years in New Zealand Police. And she told me, quote, "The New Zealand Police are so corrupt, you will either become corrupted or you will leave." Now, there's another element in this, and I think we're kind of getting a bit off topic in terms of the Auckland Unitary Plan and what have you, but I will say this. Intelligence is also, I think, an important part of being a policeman. If you can't think for yourself, it's certainly not a good idea to give you power and authority over other people. And in the United States, and it's come out in Australia, and I've heard allegations that the same is true in New Zealand, that the police have testing methods when they're recruiting, both of which measure the applicant's intelligence and their morality. If you score too high on your moral obligations in society or your intelligence, you don't get in.
Wow. Sounds odd.
Well, not really, because let's say, for instance, would you agree that there's some laws in this country that require a police officer to lie not only to themselves, but to lie to the people that they're busting? Cannabis law enforcement, for instance.
I think perhaps maybe if they had a position on cannabis, which was that it shouldn't be illegal, perhaps they might not fulfil their legal obligations to prosecute it and look the other way or something. I mean, I've been involved once several years ago where I was caught with cannabis, and the officer just said, "Oh, we'll just throw it away. You got any more, handed it all over, they threw it away." So
yeah,
good use of discretion.
Exactly. And that was my point exactly.
Yeah.
Is they can use discretion, but in a lot of cases they really don't. And you think about the harm that's caused by society. Let's say you join the police because you want to help society, you want to reduce harm in the community and what have you. Does it reduce harm in community by arresting somebody, putting them in the cells for a night, giving them a criminal conviction, clogging up the court system for a drug that has never killed anybody in 10,000 years of recorded usage and doesn't cause violence with people that take it, unless it's taken with alcohol?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely wrong.
See, so therefore, you'd actually need to be able to either believe the BS that you're being told and these laws that you should be enforcing, or you have to be a liar.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, my position on drugs is a very liberal one. I don't think prohibition works at any level. And, you know, I would like to see far more liberal laws. I think what Portugal's doing is fantastic. We're seeing drug-related harm and drug use plummet over there.
Yes.
And I think we could do the same here. Just continuing with cannabis, I'm very heartened to see the leadership changes that have happened in the ACT Party. Obviously, I left the ACT Party when John Banks got on board, because I couldn't be in a party run by a social conservative.
Yeah.
And now to see people like Jamie White, David Seymour. I mean, Jamie White's written extensively on drug legalisation. I know he's not going to make it ACT policy unless he gets a mandate from his members, so there's still a possibility there. But to have, you know, the leader of the Liberal Party, who we know definitely supports drug liberalisation, is a very positive thing.
Indeed, and we have seen a number of instances around the world just recently. Washington State and Colorado State have been full legalisation.
Yep.
And I think in the first day of Colorado legalising, they made $1 billion in taxation.
Mm.
In one day.
Yeah.
As opposed to spending $1 billion locking away non-violent drug offenders.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's a pretty straightforward positive sign, you know.
The disturbing thing is the federal government can step in at any time to end it if they choose.
Yeah, with the DEA. You're going to come to scare your PC birds. It's actually quite concerning to me on that. Because that's actually how I cut my teeth in political activism. Mm. Because I think when you have a personal experience, if you actually get arrested for cannabis at a young age, and I was, your entire world falls apart. Your entire life gets destroyed. You lose all your friends. You lose your family's trust. You get a criminal conviction. You think that your life is over. And I did. The law did far more harm to me than the drug ever did. And that inherent disparity really does need to be addressed. What's problematic is that you have people who are insane making the policy. Okay, for example, United Future, Peter Dutton's United Future. I talked to one of his candidates that was standing for the Mount Albert by-election a number of years ago,
when
Helen Clark left the seat and was replaced by David Shearer. And this United Future woman, I asked her, so what's your policy toward cannabis, and don't you think you should make it legal because the prohibition isn't working? And she goes, well, actually, I think we should just try and stop it from getting into the hands of people in order to stop it causing harm. And I go, okay, and how many years have you been trying to enact that policy by keeping it illegal? Oh, about 20, 30, 40 years. And so now that 97% of New Zealand, the population from the ages of 18 to 25, 87% had tried cannabis, and over 50% in the 40-plus age range have tried cannabis. Your policy isn't working. It's actually doing the exact opposite. And they can't see that. They can't see facts. Why is that?
And it's interesting. I mean, a slight criticism of Jamie White is that he says he wants to wait until the public's on board with drug law reform before he would look at advancing it as an act policy. Polls consistently show 75% of people support decriminalisation or legalisation, yet in Parliament we have a party that polls around 12% in the Greens, and the leader of a party which polls 0% in ACT are the only ones supporting it. National and Labour say, not going to happen with us, but there's clear public support for it.
Well, and it's because they're doing deals with Peter Dunne.
Yeah, yeah.
Every single fucking election!
Doesn't matter which election, Peter Dunne gets a deal.
Yeah, he gets a deal! And ironically, his deal is to keep the dealers in business by keeping it illegal!
And interestingly, he always wants the Minister of Revenue job. What a scummy minister to be! Who wants that job?
I want the revenue.
I want to be the taxman.
I think it was Mark Twain that says, you know what the difference between a taxidermist and a taxman is? The taxidermist leaves the skin. And taxation in and of itself, if it's not apportioned taxation, it's immoral, in my opinion. And income taxes is something I did want to talk to you about as well. I mean, let's say in an ideal world, let's say you're Prime Minister and you've been given the dictatorial power that is given to a Prime Minister of New Zealand. You can elect all the cabinet members. You can ram through any parliaments, any act or law you want under urgency. Nobody can do anything about it if you've got a majority. Would you pass any draconian laws to stop us being taxed unlawfully?
I have been an advocate of voluntary taxation for many, many years. I realise it doesn't have public support, so these days I advocate a low flat tax. I also advocate a high income tax free threshold of $15,000 a year. In an ideal world, yes, a voluntary taxation system which funds the courts, the police, the justice system, that would be my ideal. And you might go, well, who's going to donate to these things? Well, the role of the police, the justice and the military system in an ideal world is to protect the liberty of the individual. It's in everyone's interest to ensure there's a body protecting their liberties. Businesses can't function in a capitalist society if there's no way of enforcing contracts or protecting their property. But, you know, I've accepted that the public's not going to buy into that. So I think we always will have an income tax, but I think it should be flat and it should be as low as possible.
And where does all the current income taxes go?
Social welfare, health, education are the big spending areas.
Now, do they publish stats of that every year, exactly how much tax has been given to the government specifically by income taxes? No other form of taxation. There's hundreds of forms of taxation. What does the income tax specifically go to? Is there ever any sheets or printouts to explain to people where that income tax goes?
It comes out every budget. I don't have the figure off the top of my head, unfortunately.
Have you ever seen it once?
Yeah. Okay. It is on the internet. I will be able to find your website when I get home.
Okay. Because I was under the impression that income taxes simply go to pay the interest on the foreign debt, and all the other forms of taxes are usually apportioned, and they go to running the country.
Okay, I don't think that's correct.
Okay.
But, yeah, I don't have all the exact figures on the top of my head right now.
All right. Well, my feeling on this is also banking reform needs to happen, and happen sooner rather than later in this country. I'm concerned about the World Bank having or its role and its general policies being implemented in countries when people aren't even aware of those policy implementations. I think in the mid-90s there was a... If I remember correctly, there was a white paper that was leaked called 111 Points for Privatisation, a leaked document by the World Bank that chronicles an entire setup to how to take a publicly owned and democratically elected society to a completely privately owned, corporate-run society using these World Bank methodologies. Privatise the water, privatise the police, privatise the army, and eventually privatise the government, so that every person who's elected is elected because a corporation financed them. Every time people pay for something, it's something that they've already paid for through their taxes and simply have to pay again to a massive corporation. And I don't see a hell of a lot of difference between that happening in Argentina and what's happening here gradually, step by step. And now, it occurs to me that because we're borrowing money rather than creating our own equity with our own backed currency, that the banks can literally create money out of thin air to loan to people, and it disproportionately affects the way the economy works, and it disproportionately takes the power away from people being able to create, or the people, allegedly, being able to create their own money that is sound and backed versus international banks being able to create their own money out of nothing with zero backing, zero reserves.
Yep. Federal Reserve is a prime example of that. And when we look at the subprime crisis, which resulted in the recession about 5 years ago, there was no market correction. The Federal Reserve intervened, it bought up all the bad debt, it bailed out the banks, and then it started printing valueless money, which has seen the US dollar value drop. None of that should have happened, because when you have a bubble, which was caused by the Federal Reserve policies anyway, encouraging people who can't afford loans into housing, you need a market correction. Otherwise, it just drags the recession out and makes the recovery much slower and much more painful. Have the quick correction. It is a bit harsh in the meantime, but then you recover very quickly. There was a recession in the United States in 1920 over in a year. No Federal Reserve interference. And then we look again at the depression following the stock market crash in 1929. That depression dragged out for a decade, right up until World War II, and that was at the time when Roosevelt was creating all these social programs, social welfare, public health, etc.
Incidentally, he also approved $1 trillion worth of loans during the depression to be given directly to Germany so it could build its war machine. You can't make this stuff up.
No.
You know, it's like, okay, my own people are suffering. There's no work. There's no money anywhere. Let's give $1 trillion to the Germans. That'll help.
Yeah,
sure enough, it did.
Yeah.
Because without a massive German war machine to oppose, you wouldn't have revitalized the American industry by building tanks, bombs, and guns in order to go kill them.
Yeah.
You know, war is very profitable, especially if you're a banker who finances both frickin' sides.
Yeah. And I think that taxation was still around the 80% mark all the way through World War II as well. So any recovery was completely state funding driven. But those things are always temporary. You can only spend valueless money for so long.
Yeah. Well, unless, of course, you just make the money up. Now, I was talking with Suzanne Peisel from the US Independent yesterday, and she was laughing at people who were talking about the dollar collapse. Mm. And it was like, well, hold on a second. How can you say that the dollar collapse is laughable? And she goes, well, look at what all the bankers are doing. They're moving all of their money out of the paper assets and into digital currencies now. There isn't going to be a dollar collapse. It's simply going to be digitized and become a world global currency. There isn't really going to be a collapse of any kind of that nature, she's telling me.
And they're doing that because of the quantitative easing.
Yeah. Mm. Now, do you feel quantitatively eased by that?
No, it freaks me out. I'm Weimar Republic, mass money printing. Zimbabwe, mass money printing. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
What is it? It's like $500 trillion to buy a loaf of bread in Zimbabwe now.
But I was talking with Vince Singer, who's a New Zealand court watchdog, right? And it was his opinion that New Zealand could actually learn a lot of good lessons about its policies and laws and everything from Robert Mugabe. Which is real funny, because a week or two before he told that to me, I was saying the same thing.
Don't tell too many people that.
Oh yeah. We've got some real policy changes in the works, you know.
Yeah.
And I was just like really taken aback at just how big the debt is growing. And it doesn't change. We elect Labour, they tripled health spending.
Mm.
And then after their third term of tripling the health spending, the amount of people killed by the health system then started to triple the road toll. It's just like, that doesn't make any freaking sense. Where's all this money going? I mean, are they just paying assassins to execute people with poison pills in the hospitals? Where's all this money coming from? And it's kind of like third world, right? I think my American producer, when I first started off doing this radio show, you know, Americans, I don't have a hell of a lot of knowledge about this world that they own and dominate, but he was saying that New Zealand's like a small town pretending to be a country. And I'm kind of like thinking about this as well. It's actually more like a third world country pretending to be a first world country, right? In a third world country, you go out, you can bribe cops, you can bribe politicians and things like that, and it's just kind of part of life, and everybody knows it's corrupt. New Zealand's different in that it's just as corrupt, and you can do just as much bribery and scumbaggery in this country and get covered up by the courts and what have you, except people have this perception that it's not corrupt.
Well, the politicians can still be bought by donations. There's no denying that. And again, it's not the donations to the politicians that's the problem. The problem is the power the politicians have to attract those donations and hand out favours.
See, and again, this is another discussion I was having with our mutual friend Will Ryan about the government having a monopoly of force.
Mm.
Now, no corporation would go after a politician to try and bribe him for doing something if the government couldn't offer them a monopoly of force and guaranteed contracts as a result.
That's right, yeah.
All right, you remove those barriers.
Mm.
Can we do that? I mean, if there was something to be legislated in New Zealand to prevent that kind of thing from happening, what would it look like?
I highly doubt we'll ever get to the point where the government's monopoly of force disappears. I don't think the voting... I mean, to do that, you'd have to go to a libertarian system. And I don't think the voting public is anywhere near advocating for that system. So all we really can do is try to take incremental steps to minimise the power of the state. But I think they'll always have that power of coercion. And I don't say that because I think it's a good thing, simply because that's how I think it'll work.
Yeah, I think you're correct on that that one. And you're talking about the public and what they are prepared for and what they're not prepared for. What occurs to me is social engineering is at play here.
Mm.
And as we discussed in the previous segment, the left, alleged left, is just as central as the alleged right.
Yep.
Which I think is actually part of the social engineering game, so that you capture people, much like the way that the Satanic Church and the Catholic Church works is somebody will go into the Catholic Church, they get disillusioned and they go, well, God can't be for me, that means Satan must be for me. And then they go into the Satanic Church and they go, well, Satan's not for me, I'm going to go back to being a hardcore Bible thumper. And I think that's what happens.
Yep.
You've got these two terrible organizations that just keep manipulating people, and they bounce back and forth like a freaking pinball, never realizing that both of them are full of crap.
Yeah, which is kind of like our two-party system, isn't it?
Well, it's like even a two-party system. And I think it's like, as I mentioned, full-spectrum dominance. Visual light comes from ultraviolet all the way through to infrared.
Mm.
What are the two colours of the two main parties in every single freaking country?
Red and blue.
Red and blue, you know? Mm. They're literally working on a spectrum. And what I see happening now is, you know what the central colour is on the spectrum? Red's on one side, blue's on the other. What's central? Green! What's happening here? And this is my theory, and I could be wrong.
Alright.
Is that both the left and the right are actually left. They're actually all greenies, really, at heart, and they're all fighting for sustainability at the end of the day. And what we're doing here is they're using the spectrum to move people very, very slowly into this green, socialist, kind of totalitarian future sort of thing. Would you agree with that? Or at least see a general trend in that direction.
Yeah, there's some merit in what you're saying there. I mean, the natural order for governments is to pass more and more and more and more laws. That's their entire job, passing laws. They've been doing it for decades. The right wants to control what we do with our bodies, the left wants to control what we do with our money, and both sides just keep on passing laws based on that. I don't really fit into the left or the right, because I want people to do what they want with their bodies as well as their money and property, so...
Yeah.
Mm. Well, but of course I keep on getting called right-wing, but it's not really the case.
Well, I don't know, anybody who calls you a name and tries to pigeonhole you usually doesn't know where they stand on any particular issues and don't even understand what left or right actually means.
Yeah.
I mean, if you take, I believe when I was 15 in history class at Waiheke High School, I saw this poster that my history teacher had on the wall, and it had on one side, left-wing extremism, which is total government domination of everybody's lives, no freedom, etc. And on the full hardcore right-winger, it was total government domination of everybody's lives, no freedom, or anything.
Yeah.
So you go to either extreme and they come into the exact same thing. That's how they've gotten away with it for so long, is because people think there's a difference.
Yeah, and there isn't.
There isn't.
The only difference is what they want to control.
Yeah. But the ultimate thing is they both want the same thing. Mm. Control.
Just
control for control's sake.
Mm.
And they gradually accumulate more and more of it until eventually you don't have any control over your own life, because it'll all be decided for you.
Yep.
And I think Bill Cooper... great American talk radio show host, like the progenitor of Alex Jones, more or less, he said that socialism is like living with daddy, okay? It means daddy pays for the roof over your head, daddy pays for your food, daddy pays for the electricity, and, you know, keeps you safe and what have you, and provides you a car to use. But if you want to go to the next town, if you want to take daddy's car to go to a party or something like that, you have to have daddy say so.
Mm.
If he tells you to take out the garbage, you have to take out the garbage. So you're trading a gilded cage, right?
Yep.
That's all that it is saying, more or less, you're admitting to yourself that you don't have enough personal strength or integrity or intelligence to make your own decisions in your own life.
That's right.
And that's why you vote socialism.
Yep, couldn't agree more.
Why do people think like that? And I don't think they came up with it themselves. I think there's been a slow process of, pseudo-mind control, more or less, through the culture over the latter half of the 20th century, I think, of that nature.
There's been very few examples of governments throughout history where which are not control-based. I mean, we could look at the US when it was initially founded. That constitution is a pretty good freedom-based document, but there's very few other examples that we can point to.
So, if these few examples wind up getting taken over by tyranny in the first place after they start off as libertarians, it brings into mind what Thomas Jefferson was saying, that the price of freedom really is eternal vigilance.
Yes. And, you know, people vote with their back pockets. They see the short-term incentive, oh, the government's going to give me welfare if I'm unemployed or something like that, and that just starts off more and more control. Then you have to be taxed to fund that, and that's another right being taken away from you.
It's one thing leading to another, yeah?
Yep.
Okay. Now, unlike most people in the current political sphere, I've read into Agenda 21, I've studied the things about the New World Order, the Rockefellers and the bankers and what have you, so I know... based upon the documents and based upon admissions from high-level officials, that there is a ruling elite that runs the world, that controls banking systems and wants to produce a one-world government with a global tyranny. And when you have that mindset, as I do, it almost biases your ears to a degree. So if somebody says one thing and you instantly see the agenda at play there, kind of thing. And the thing is, where is the credible resistance to this kind of thing in the official spectrum? I mean, you and the Affordable Auckland and other affordable cities campaigns have indeed started to walk, I believe, in the right direction by addressing some of these core issues that are actually affecting New Zealanders that live in our urban areas, and that's really good. However, as a result of this, you know, in my opinion, overarching agenda, you wind up getting pigeonholed, phased out, demonised, derailed, and then become unsuccessful. And it's not because you can't do the job, it's because certain interests don't want you to, because they stand to lose power from it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't share your view about a small group controlling the world. I'm a bit sceptical about that. But I'm certainly not a supporter of things like a World Bank organisation. I'm not a fan of the United Nations, the IMF, all these sorts of things. I don't like international organisations which override a country's sovereignty, because those organisations can be used to strip individual rights in that country. And so I'm fine with globalism. I think trading with other countries is exactly what we should be doing. That's what generates our wealth. But there shouldn't be this coercive control that we see through these international banking organisations, etc. Let's talk about the bailout of Greece. Obviously a complete basket case economy. The things that they needed to do to turn that around, the austerity, probably the right thing. Now, some parts are the right thing to do. The government spending definitely did need to come down. But of course, when you reduce government spending and put up taxes, you kill your economy anyway. What probably should have happened there is just to let the market correction happen. Yes, it will be extremely tough on the populace in the short term when you have that correction. But if you don't allow the market to correct, you just drag out the misery. And yeah, I don't think there should have been a bailout by the European Union, and I don't support those sorts of financial arrangements that they have over there.
Well, I say I look at it as a very simple thing. Do you believe that positions of wealth and power attract the wrong people sometimes?
Absolutely. And the reason that happens is because governments have powers that they shouldn't have. The role of the government should be just to protect our individual liberty, run a court system, run the police. I don't have a major issue with having a public health system. I mean, I do believe in having a safety net for society's most vulnerable, but it's probably gone too far now. We're spending too much money, we're taxing too high. We really do need to limit the power of the government as much as possible.
What kind of safeguards do you think we could be able to put in place in order to protect the people from an overarching government? I mean, I think the United States, with its Second Amendment clause, which is if the government turns tyrannical, you can shoot them.
I'm a big supporter of the Second Amendment. I don't own a gun myself. I don't recall I've ever actually fired one. But I do believe in gun rights. I do believe that people should be able to carry a weapon and have the means to defend themselves if necessary. And, I mean, obviously it is a means for defending yourself from a tyrannical government. I think the US Constitution, in its initial drafting, was actually an excellent document, and I would like to see something similar in New Zealand. Currently, we have no real constitution. We have no limits on government power. We're just lucky that they've been relatively benevolent thus far.
Oh, yeah. Allegedly.
Relatively, yeah. Yeah.
I see, and again, it depends upon how far you look into it. I mean, I'm in the... I don't know if it's a fortunate or unfortunate position that I'm in to actually speak to people on a daily basis, more or less, that have had bad things that the New Zealand government has done to them. And not only that, but actually showing me a microcosm of actually how the true system works. And I've developed this philosophy that if it comes from an official source, whatever they say that they're doing, whatever they say that their intention is, it's probably the opposite. And if you can't cook it or make it yourself in your kitchen, then it's a soft kill bioweapon, right? And, yep. and that's essentially what has happened to me is you see the government. What's the stated intention of the government? They're to protect you, right? Protect your rights.
That's my view. Yes.
Right, so therefore, they're there to take away your rights and enslave you, which is exactly what's happened.
Yep. Well, there's always the law of unintended consequences when just about anything a government does. If we have a look at when they introduced the DPP. I think it was in the early 70s, you know, it was just there to look after the small number of single mothers who needed financial help. But it hasn't resulted in that. It's resulted in an explosion of single mothers who can't look after themselves.
I think that would probably be the result of feminism rather than the other one. I think there was a step. I forget what it was. I think it was something like 90% of female graduates from United States colleges in 1979 never had children.
Yeah.
And this this product of, again, social engineering has actually created massive consequences and layers upon layers on. It's what I call unintended consequences. So yeah. You have unintended consequences and a whole bunch of little offshoots and spectrum off of that.
Yep, and another example of unintended consequences, I used to work for Aerox many years ago. I sold party pills. And those were the BZP ones, and as far, and I still maintain that BZP is a relatively safe drug. Then that got banned, and it got replaced by this new whole lot of filthy crap. I mean, I've tried them, they make me feel sick, I don't touch the things now. And also years ago, when you had the BZP, you had these things called Spice, which were meant to be like a cannabis substitute. And those were pretty benign as well. I tried them, you know, didn't think much of them, didn't smoke them again, but you know, no health effects. And then these things get progressively banned, and the companies start bringing out more and more products which just get worse and worse and worse. And so the government thinks they're making us safer by banning these products, when actually we're just getting exposed to more horrible crap as a result of their intervention.
Exactly. I think this is also the main problem with cannabis prohibition as well, is yeah. that you have a look at all the side effects and what have you. Look, nobody has died in 10,000 years of recorded usage of cannabis, apart from the people getting shot in the back running away from the police. And then, of course, if you make it illegal, but if there's a market demand for something, people will try and fulfill that demand so that they can make money off of what the public wants. Why has the government not cottoned on to this?
Capitalism works, mate. No matter how many laws you pass, capitalism will continue to work.
It'll continue to work. Unless, of course, you subvert it and wrap it in a flag of some description and tell everybody that socialism is capitalism. You know, and I'm also concerned about the international trade agreements that we've got, like the TPPA and what have you. Totally secret, has massive abilities for international corporations to come in, and you can't be held accountable to a law that a country makes if you're an international company under this agreement, more or less, right? So if a tobacco company comes in and they say, well, New Zealand's laws require taxation on our products, that goes against our competitive model. We're going to sue you in the world court, which us corporations own and always get the judgment we want. And so your country will be fined for making legal things happen that threaten a corporation's economic viability.
Yep.
In principle, that doesn't actually sound like too bad an idea. Like, it's actually a really bad idea for a government to just restrict and destroy business left, right, and centre, open slather. But if you put it back on the other spectrum, a corporation dominates the government, doesn't it? There's a delicate balance that needs to be struck here. And I don't think those delicate balances can be struck with absolute secrecy. That needs to be leaked by WikiLeaks in order for people to know what the hell's going on.
Yeah, well, I would like to discuss the TPPA a wee bit. Obviously, the issue is that it is still secret, so the opponents of it are telling me, oh, it's going to do all these bad things. They don't actually know, because it's secret.
Yeah.
My usual instinct is to support free trade agreements, but once again, I don't know what's in the TPPA, so I can't say I support it or don't support it.
Yeah, yeah.
If it eliminates tariffs, if it eliminates government control on businesses, and I mean that in the sense that businesses are free to trade with their customers, I don't mean in the sense that corporations start controlling governments. But
statistically, that's what always happens.
Yes, yes. So if it results in less regulations over the market and freer trade, great, support it. I think that's a fantastic thing. But I don't know if the TPPA is actually going to do that, and I'd like to know what's in it.
Well, every free trade deal that I've actually looked over and seen the results of, all it is a precursor for even greater government power.
Well, it's not free trade, it's managed trade.
Well, exactly. What they do is, again, if it's an official source, it's the opposite. So if they say it's a free trade agreement, that's a slave trade agreement, all right?
Yep.
So let's take the European Economic Community, for example. They say, oh, we're going to have free trade, it's going to be a great or a little trading organisation, and then all of a sudden you've got a European Parliament that is passing draconian laws across everybody else's country's governments and all of that kind of stuff, and completely subverting everybody's freedoms, and that all started with, it's going to be good for trade.
Have you seen how thick the regulations on bananas in the EU are?
Sweet mother
of mercy. About that thick.
See, and again, this proves my point, doesn't it?
Yes, yes.
Is if you're trying to create economic prosperity through legislation, it does the direct opposite. It only winds up making it worse.
And, I mean, free trade agreement with China. You know, I was the first to say, great, free trade with China. Support that, but even years later, we don't actually have free trade with China. There are still tariffs on our wood imports into China. That's not free trade, it's a trade agreement.
Yeah.
And I suspect that the TPPA will end up being the same thing. It'll be a trade agreement, but it won't actually be free.
And again, anybody tells you I'm going to do this, it'll be free or what have you, there ain't nothing free in this world.
But I'm still going to reserve my judgment until I've seen everything in it, but I am suspicious.
WikiLeaks has leaked the documents, so they're there. They're there for public scrutiny. And what happened in the House, I think it was Winston Peters, David Cunliffe, and Russell Norman, the Greens, Labour, and New Zealand First, basically the opposition leaders, all attempted in the House of Parliament upon the discussion of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, attempted to table this document that was leaked from WikiLeaks. And the government's response was, we don't look at anything from WikiLeaks, because it reveals damaging things, right? And these are real documents, they've been confirmed, they've been verified, and it's very, very damaging to the government. And so the government, instead of taking responsibility and saying, yeah, I guess it's not that good, maybe we should amend it a little bit, they go, it doesn't exist, even though it's right there in their hands, and we're not going to allow you to table it.
Yeah, yeah.
That strikes me as a very, very childish approach to public policy setting. And indeed, one of my guests a while ago, I forget exactly who it was, but they had a 6-year-old child that they took into Parliament just to watch Parliament in session. And the child was seeing these politicians arguing back and forth. And the child looks up at his dad and he goes, man, Dad, they're like a bunch of kids.
They really are.
That's, I think, one of the natural consequences of bad parenting, right?
Yeah.
In other words, no discipline. Now, did you know that there's no code of conduct for parliamentarians? No enforceable code of conduct?
There is a code, I believe, but it's not enforceable. You're right.
What kind of a country has no actual rules?
Well, we don't even have an actual constitution.
Yeah. we don't have a constitution, we don't have any actual rules in Parliament. The Prime Minister comes in, gets elected, regardless of which party, and he gets to handpick this completely unelected cabinet. Incidentally, when the Super City came in, when you get elected mayor, you get to handpick your completely unelected cabinet as well.
Yeah, it's a little bit different. They're more advisors. They don't have any actual power. But what does concern me about the Super City is the Independent Maori Statutory Board.
Really? I haven't heard about that.
Okay. They're built into the Super City legislation, and they are elected by a mana whenua committee, basically. I think there's maybe a dozen...
Is that money of the land?
Yes, it's a committee of mana whenua who were elect from... You know, a dozen of them. The two people who are going to be on the people who are going to be on the Independent Maori Statutory Board. Sorry, so there's two people who get to vote on council legislation. The board itself is actually bigger, but there'll always be two of them who can vote. You know, on a committee or on a council vote or things like that. And they're not elected by the people. So I mean, that's incredibly disturbing. John Tamahiri's on the statutory board.
Of course,
I'm not sure who else is.
Yeah.
I get really disturbed by the amount of advisory boards we have as well. I mean, we've got a Pacific Affairs Advisory Board. Len Brown yesterday at the Big Gay Out was saying he wants an advisory board for gays, lesbians, and transgender. And you might think, oh, well, I'm gay, I'll go hooray. But no, I won't, because I think it's actually incredibly offensive that they would have this idea that all gay, lesbian and transgender people think the same. So men who have sex with men, women who have sex with women, people who aren't sure what sex they are, people who have sex with everyone, and people who have changed their sex, according to Len Brown's logic, all think the same.
Well, you know, we need some sensitivity training, you know.
Yeah.
And this is another thing that I find very interesting about the gay and lesbian community is they're so fractured, it's just not funny.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There is no unitary thing. As far as I'm concerned, there's only one person in one social group, the individual.
Yes.
If you start bargaining for people on a collective basis, you wind up destroying everybody's rights.
Yeah, you can't have a gay opinion.
Yeah.
You can have the activist at the top saying, give us more money. That's usually their opinion. But there is no gay opinion. There's no Maori opinion. There's no Asian opinion.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody's... We're all snowflakes.
We're all snowflakes, darling.
And it was just like... What the frack is going on here? PC God, Matt, that's what it is.
Yeah.
We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Bear in mind, this is a listener-supported broadcast, so if you like these kind of discussions happening, where we're actually doing the job the media really should be doing, having intense conversations, long form, with activists and people of great political thinkers of our times, go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Corporate media needs corporate funding. Real media needs funding from real people. I would love if everybody who listened to the show would donate a couple of dollars a month. You can donate between $1 and $100 a month. I don't give a crap which. As long as you give something to the real emergent media in this country and the voices that I ensure get recorded and published for public scrutiny. I'm simply trying to facilitate the debate. We'll be right back.
Well,
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the most thrilling 3 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the wonderful little nation. You know, you've got to really love this country, especially because we're the only country that allows 1080 to be used for outdoor use. Everywhere else it's illegal, which is incidentally why it kills all the deer and the possums and the local bird life and everything like that to maintain our wonderful pristine bush free of life. My very special guest is none other than number three.
And the highest polling not tainted by the Len Brown scandal.
Well, you do want to make sure you don't get tainted by Brown.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's not the case for the city currently.
No.
Yeah. Now, speaking of which, we've got a protest coming up, and as a long-time activist, I've been to countless protests. This is the first one that I will ever attend. Maybe it might be the last one as well, of somebody actually of a right-wing persuasion doing the protesting, because protesting is a left-wing thing, isn't it?
It is.
I was criticised by Will Ryan a number of years ago, saying that, Vinnie, you never go to any right-wing protests. Well, bro, there aren't any! Right-wingers take personal responsibility for problems and then go off and solve them. Left-wingers come together with a large group of other people who've got the same complaints so they can continue to complain together and think that they've got a majority. Am I wrong? Maybe that's a bit too, I don't know, accurate. But yeah, I mean, in terms of actually protesting, you've protested before about things, haven't you?
Yeah, I've many years ago we had the Walk for Capitalism when I was in the Libertarians Party. Got a dozen people together, so not very successful. I've turned up to Waitangi a couple of times, handful of us. So yeah, most of the protesting I did when I was younger was actually counter-protesting, like the GE marches and things like that. So, you know, I couldn't get my own protest together. I had to piggyback off other people's. So this is really my first protest that I've ever organised, and probably the biggest one as well. Who knows how many people's going to come, but the amount of positive feedback I've been getting, 75% of people I talk to are like, yes, we've got to get rid of them. Yes, we'd love to come along to the protest. I think this is going to be a biggie.
Well, let's hope so. I have my reservations and doubts that it's going to accomplish a whole lot, because in my experience, protesting accomplishes nothing.
Well, you know, it may not get Len Brown to resign on itself, but we need to maintain constant pressure.
Yes.
He thinks it's all blown over. He thinks he can go back to photo opportunities, etc. And we need to be constantly on his ass, letting him know that it's not over, Len. Nobody's forgetting. We're going to keep holding you to account until you're gone.
Until such a time as the mainstream media stops paying it any attention and people forget because they're watching X Factor. I see, that's the laugh of approval. It's unfortunate, you know, because if you're trying to discuss serious political issues, it becomes apparent very quickly early on in the piece that people don't have the time nor the inclination to engage seriously with political issues. Even people who are members of political parties and registered voters who are actually quite passionate about their politics are indeed very, very unwilling to do anything to actually affect politics. They believe that democracy is something that you do once every 4 years by ticking a box for the person that you haven't studied, don't know what their policy is.
Yep, and let's be fair, people are time poor. They have lives to live, they've got to put food on the table, they've got to pay the rent, they've got to go to their jobs. I routinely work about 60 hours a week in my day job, and then I go home and spend the next few hours working on politics until I go to sleep. So I'm essentially working from dawn to dusk. I'm on annual leave for the next 2 weeks to promote the protest. I'm not on a holiday, I'm working. So, I mean, if you really want to affect change and get a voice across, it's an incredible amount of hard work, and I don't blame people for saying, well, you know, I'm busy. It's unfortunate that they actually have to dedicate so much more time out of their spare time to change these issues.
It's a disillusioning process I've found. For example, when Occupy Auckland started up, I was told by one of the occupiers that this is it, it's the revolution, and so on and so forth, and it suddenly felt like I was a salty sea dog of some description, virtually laughing at the concept that one movement is suddenly going to change everything, especially one that's obtaining any kind of media coverage and what have you, because it always winds up getting subverted and then ruthlessly crushed after people have forgotten about it.
And people just get bored.
Yeah.
It's hard to drag out an issue for months and months. I mean, the Len Brown issue really is quite unique in that respect. This was broken, in November, October? And months later, we're still talking about it. The mainstream media is still covering it every chance they get. This is quite a unique issue, and we certainly shouldn't waste it. Let's keep the pressure on until he goes.
Yeah. I mean, do you really think that he's actually going to wind up going? Or is it just going to be like one of those things that happens where there will be a bit of a scandal and then there'll be a little bit of a public attention and then it'll eventually fade away and they continue to do whatever they were doing beforehand without really much intervention from the public?
I don't know. I like to be optimistic. I wouldn't dedicate so much time to it were I not. But the great thing about this scandal is it's a scandal that keeps on giving. First we have this...
As did Len Brown.
But I mean, even before the election, his scandalous financial mismanagement, rates going up 10% annually in some areas, the spending keeps on going up, it keeps on getting wasted on skateboard ambassadors. We've got a bloody artificial sand pit over by the viaduct now. The borrowing, $1 billion last year, $1.2 billion this year, it's going to be $10 billion by the end of this term. The constant house prices going up, it's not all Len Brown's fault, but I can tell you a lot of his policies are contributing to that.
Yeah.
And then there's his personal scandals, free hotel rooms, $40,000 of hotel room upgrades.
Whoa!
Yep, and I mean, even before this, there were the credit card scams when he was mayor of Manukau. There was the...
Oh, could you explain that a little?
He bought dinner and wine and things on his council credit card and got busted.
Oh, I recall, yes.
Even in, I think it would have been the 2010 election, there was the controversy over him using... property owned by the Manukau, I think it's the Manukau Pacific Trust, to put up his billboards, value of $3,000. That trust is headed by a major contributor to his campaign. There is, and you know, you don't really see that on the media, that never really got covered, but there is a long trend of dodgy dealings and corruption from this mayor.
The likes of which nobody cared about or heard about until he dipped his nuggets in some sweet and chilli sauce.
And then suddenly it gets interesting.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, if you put a hot girl in, and attach that to a story, of course it becomes a little bit more interesting.
Well, she is a burlesque dancer. It's got all the hallmarks of a fantastic scandal.
She was a burlesque dancer as well. It just keeps getting worse. Poor old Len Brown.
And I guess the worst thing he could have done is get caught by a prostitute. So
he got caught by a prostitute doing all of this? No.
It would have been worse if he had, I guess. That's the only thing worse he could have done.
Okay. Well, you know, at least he wasn't purchasing porn with his parliamentary credit card, as has happened to some other politicians.
Yeah, that was a bit silly.
I'm just kind of starting to see the length of debauchery and scandal within New Zealand politicians, and you just wonder... how much of it's actually not being reported on at all? Like, how many of our politicians are actually kind of dirty, but they're just holding back on the blackmail and the media until such a time as that's convenient?
No, I mean, lots of politicians have skeletons in their closet. I mean, as John Key said, it's hard to find anyone that's lived an entire life of blameless excellence. I mean, if that were the prerequisite for getting into politics, Parliament would be empty, I'm sure. With Len Brown, as I've said before, I don't care about his affair. That's his private life. But everything else he's done, the corruption, the financial mismanagement, the hanky-panky on the job, that's something we should definitely be focusing on. And there is a long history of this sort of thing going on, so we can't let him get away with it now.
Well, funnily enough... the sex scandal provided an opening.
Yeah.
And I think, exploitation can be a really bad thing, except if it's as particular incidents used to exploit the weaknesses of somebody who's actually doing bad things constantly.
Yeah, yeah.
Would you say that that's actually the case in Len Brown, that he's actually been kind of doing bad things pretty much constantly,
yep.
But it's taken this public scandal in order to bring light to some of these issues?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I've heard it said before, the media doesn't do stories about issues, they do things about people. And all this previous corruption, the credit card, the sign on a trust property, etc. Those are all just issues and sideshows. But then once you get this person involved, all the media's right over it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't like mainstream media because of that fact.
Mm.
If it bleeds, it leads, or if it... It's not a...
a terrible term to use.
Yeah. Especially if we're talking about a woman's reproductive tract. Now,
let's not talk about that.
Let's not talk about it. And it occurs to me that because of the fact that the media's not doing what I would consider to be doing journalistic due diligence, somebody somewhere... must be covering up somehow for these kind of things. How deep does it go? Where are these connections? How is it even possible for this to happen? That's my real worry about this, because if you have a corrupt politician and it's being covered up by a corrupt media, how do we know that anything that is going on in our society that's being reported on is even true, or even if there's a deeper story, if we don't have other, shall we say, independent media like myself to hold them to account?
Yep, and how many things are going on that we don't know about? Cameron Slater has indicated there's more to come. Dick Quacks has indicated there's more to come.
There's actually a dude named Dick Quacks?
Yes, he's a councillor for Howick.
Well,
he was an Olympic athlete.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Looks like a duck, quacks like a duck.
He's a good guy. I've heard rumours about other women. I mean, I can't say anything more than that. I've only heard rumours. But I suspect there is a lot more to come out of this. And the longer Len Brown stays on, the more the scandal's going to keep giving, I think. What we've got, the evidence we've got already, maybe he can survive on that and tough it out, and 6 months later people will forget about it. But there's going to be more. Mm. I'm sure there is.
Well, one can only hope. But, again, with my conspiratorial mind, I always think that there's something deeper going on, and that maybe even the scandal with Len Brown is covering up for something else that the media should actually be paying attention to right now.
Mm.
What if there's some other kind of big plans in the works? What if the government's doing something right now that, for example, is being lessened by the blow lessened on it as a result of the increased media coverage on Len Brown? Deep sea oil drilling, for example, springs to mind. There was an article in the paper not too long ago that Anadarko was drilling a new hole off of the coast of New Zealand and they found nothing.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Which just goes to show how safe deep sea oil drilling is, because there was nothing leaked.
Yeah. You know, I mean, that's the only time when it's safe. On the one hand, here, this is this big scandal. Like they always tend to distract from other issues that are going on, and the media format that I see is like this 30-second soundbite type of thing. It's not like an interview like you or I are doing now, where you've got extended periods of time to explain ideas in detail if you wish to.
Yep.
It's more about tiny little snippets of information that don't really tell the whole story, distract people from the reality and keep them focused elsewhere.
Yep. I mean, remember it's legendary now that Lindsay Perigo quit TVNZ in the early 90s, labelling it brain dead because all the interviews were cut down to quick 5-minute things. The media started running on sound bites. Whereas prior to that, you know, you would fill up a whole current affairs show just interviewing one person. The mainstream media now runs on very small snippets, small sound bites that they can get into a 2-minute piece, and you don't really see the whole depth of an issue.
I think that this is a deliberate agenda to dumb down the public, to reduce our attention span and our willingness to sit through interviews that would indeed connote some form of understanding on real issues. Mm. That way the understanding and the implementation of issues and policy lays specifically with the person doing it, not the public to which they're supposed to be accountable.
Just as a side issue, perhaps Twitter's a symptom of that dumbing down. Messages that can only be 150 letters.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's surprising. You can just fit a lot of intelligence into only a few sentences of dialogue. Mm. I think Mark Twain once said that those who read newspapers are less informed than those who read nothing at all. you know, there's things like that that can be done. Like, as I said to you during the break, the large print giveth and the small print taketh away.
Yes.
You know, sound bites can actually connote something real, but the problem is the world's not a frickin' simple place.
No.
It's actually really complicated. You actually can't explain everything in 30 seconds. And I think this is possibly the reason why the general public still vote for one or either of the mainstream parties, is because they're too dumb to know what those parties stand for.
I won't label them dumb, but...
To a degree, shall we say...
Old habits.
Not informed enough, shall we say. So if we're capable of informing the general public, you would wind up having representation in government that would be accurate rather to the truth of the matter and what a government should actually be there to do, i.e. protecting people's rights and the general comings and goings of entrepreneurs and business people and what have you to prevent criminals from taking over the country. Unfortunately, the government has become the criminals that have taken over the country because the people don't know that they're criminals.
Yeah. And it's surprising when we have, 15 to 20, well, have probably just under 20 registered political parties by the next election, yet we're still dominated by just two.
Well, and again, the Greens seem to be capitalising on this disenfranchisement quite remarkably. What are they, 11% now in the last election?
I've seen them polling up to 14% at times.
And so we've got those people on the left who want to combine the Greens with Labour, and I spoke to Ian Wishart and I asked him how he was voting in the, I think it was the 2012 election, or it might have been 2008, I forget which, and he said it's like shuffling the chairs on the Titanic.
Yep.
The ship's going down, man.
Yeah.
You know, what are you supposed to do with something like that? It's kind of like you become, or at least I have become, really angry. And after your anger subsides, then you become almost realistic about the situation, or if you want to be technical, depressed.
Yeah.
and that's kind of it. You become resigned to failure. Because the cards are stacked against you, okay? Like, if you want truth in this country, if you want effective public policy, if you want freedom and private property to be protected, if you want economic health and well-being, there is nobody to vote for that will win.
Mm. Yep. I've been a bit of an ACT supporter over the many years, and for me, their economic policy is very coherent. It's the sort of thing I support. But they've been derailed by sideshows and scandals with John Banks, etc. And the media is talking more about the sideshows, and nobody actually knows what ACT's about. They don't hear any of that stuff. They just hear the scandal.
That's true. No policy really seems to make it in. Like, you ask any voter who they voted for, and they go, oh, I voted Green, I voted National, I voted Labour. And then you ask them, okay, name me one policy that they implemented. Blank stare. And that's the vast majority of voters that I've spoken to. They vote for people without having a single a clue as to what they're voting for or why.
It's almost tribalistic, really. This is my tribe, that's who I'm supporting.
Yeah. I'm the only gay Eskimo in my tribe. And it occurs to me that this is something that will create a reaction. You know how they say in physics, every action is an equal and opposite reaction. So you can ignore the people for so long, you can misinform them for so long. Who was it? Was it... Bob Marley says you can fool some of the people all of the time, and all of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. Despite the very depressing realities that we've been discussing here, I still feel and see, because of my my field in which I work, a resurgence. Like, it's almost like humanity is splitting into these two factions. Those who are accepting the mind control programming of the media and the manipulation of politicians, and they're kind of like falling off to one side. Maybe the majority of people are falling into these traps over here, but there is a growing movement of people whose eyes are becoming far more open, and they see the problems for what they really are.
Yep.
I can only hope that those people do not lose their motivation to contribute to society in a positive way, as I believe that you have, and still do it.
Well, the advent of the internet's been fantastic for that as well, because I remember growing up and just blindly accepting what I read in the newspaper, and I thought the newspapers just told the truth. And then, of course, we had the debacle over BZP and all the disaster stories, hospitalisations, rah, 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 and I'm going through this, and I know that it's lies.
Well, you know, it comes to the point where you're like, okay, problem solving, all right? You're a problem solver by nature, eh?
I try to be.
All right. So, how do you solve a problem that's somebody else's fault? Yeah, it's a real puzzler, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, the mainstream media is a bit of a problem, getting your message out there accurately. I often find on the rare cases that I do get covered by them, you know, it's full of inaccuracies, but I guess it's just what happens.
Would you mind listing some of those inaccuracies?
I
heard this one interview that you did on Radio Live where the guy was just accusing you of trying to take political advantage of the Len Brown scandal and what have you.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's no secret. You know, I stood for the mayoralty before, and if there's another election, I will stand for the mayoralty again. But I wouldn't be doing this if Len Brown weren't such a terrible mayor, if he weren't corrupt. Yeah. If he was financially competent, if he wasn't screwing around on the job, I wouldn't be running this campaign right now. It'd be business as usual, and, you know, I'd just promote our ideas. But the fact that he is such a terrible mayor and he's got to go, of course I'm going to do this. He's also trying to paint us... initially he thought we were a left-wing party, and I said, well, no, we're not. What I probably should have made clearer is that we're actually a non-partisan party. We're not left-wing or right-wing, we just want lower rates. But he instantly painted us as right-wing, which simply isn't the case.
No, it's not, is it?
Mm.
Well, what's happening then in terms of this is, as I saw the person in the media interviewing you, as I just mentioned, there's this whole big issue which you're bringing up, facts, evidence, examples, and this is what the media does.
Mm.
Flip it around, make it about personality. Oh, you're just a right winger, you want to be elected.
Yep.
Right? Therefore ignore all the corruption. That's the impression.
Yeah,
that
it's an attack on me for what I'm trying to do, as opposed to dealing with the issue, which is, you know, quite unacceptable to have in a mayor of Auckland.
This has not happened to me before by the mainstream media. How did it feel when it happened to you?
I just take it on the chin. I'm a bit of a cynic, I guess.
Well, did you go in there expecting BS?
I
mean broadcasting standards.
I mean, in all seriousness, I'm quite new to having radio interviews. This is probably maybe my fifth or sixth. Previously, they've been fairly soft. I've done things on BFM and some small ethnic stations, etc. So I knew that Marcus Lush would probably be a bit of a challenge. I was prepared for some tough accusatory questions, and I guess I wasn't disappointed.
Mm-hmm. Well, where does that leave you then? I mean, I'm of the opinion that we need a media split in this country where all these mainstream apparatus and everything, with the advent of digital technology, digital television, the internet and whatnot, I don't think there is any longer any need for these massive centralised media organisations. And we were talking out on the deck about how if you want to instill libertarianism in a society, you need to take it gradually from tyranny all the way eventually over to the other spectrum of liberty. and that's by breaking up centralized control, instilling individual responsibility, and then making a little group volunteer organizations and whatnot to start compensating for the government's lack of action, or to replace government current action with voluntarism. Now, I believe the media should be split up and destroyed in much the same way. I don't mean destroy as in, oh, let's go in there with sledgehammers. I'm talking about destroy by splitting up. You take good reporters who start up their own radio show online. Yep. They start sucking a bit of the audience out of the mainstream media. And then you get an encouragement based upon that one person's success, which would lure even more people out of those mainstream media organizations. You'd be thinking about the more credible people who don't like editorial privilege messing with their stories. Those who crave independence would probably be more likely the ones to split apart from these major organizations, start their own small ones, and actually, as a result, you would wind up with a full spectrum of true coverage of issues from which eventually people would no longer want to listen to the mainstream media anymore because they feel that it is simply not relevant.
Yep, you can only do it through market competition. You certainly can't do it through regulation. But we also need to keep in mind what the actual job of the media is. It's not to report. The job of the media is to run a profitable company, and they do that by selling advertising time and entertaining their listeners so that they'll listen to the ads. So we just need to look at the media what it is. It's another enterprise to make a profit, and that's fine. That's fine. But we shouldn't delude ourselves into thinking that the job of the media is to tell the truth and report things. It's a profitable enterprise.
Well, I've got this opinion, and what I do is I don't want to sort of like full on become like so wealthy and powerful because of my media empire that anybody who attacks me, I can just demonize them and run a smear campaign and just derail their argument and whatnot. I don't want that kind of power. I want to be able to have enough money so that I'm living comfortably without the anxiety of bills having need be paid, so that I can continue to do my work and report the truth without having people telling me what I can and cannot report on. That's essentially my desire. And to create the largest online selection of interviews with people from all sorts of political spectrums of thought, spirituality, science, and all sorts of different topics. The largest one in world history. That's what I'm creating with this radio show. Now, if it was possible for me to have a media organization that's running profitably based upon telling the truth, I would really like to do that. The problem is, at the moment, I'm trying to solicit the community bank.
Yep.
So there'll be members of the community who go, I don't like the mainstream media. Vinny's doing what the media should be doing. I'm going to donate some money to him. So I'm recouping my costs.
Yep.
And making profit by telling the truth.
Yep.
And I'm surprised that I've managed to make that work, okay? Because, as we all know, isn't the first law of economics, if you're telling the truth, you're going to be a broke-ass motherfucker?
But you've identified a market as well, and it's clearly not as profitable as owning bloody Fox TV, but...
Ironically, they're not making any money.
Oh, okay.
And indeed, back in... It might have been 2007, 2006, I think. The primetime news programs like Fox News, CNN at 6 o'clock were down in the ratings, and the number one rating for that time slot was the Chuck Norris Total Gym. So people aren't listening to the... You're familiar with the term paper tiger?
Yes.
Well, they perceive to have all this power and all this credibility, but they don't actually have any. They perceive to have all this money, but they don't actually have any. And even more evidence of that, who's the former CEO of MediaWorks, TB3, Radio Live, who became the government communications minister and then brokered a $37 million bailout for TB3 because of unpaid broadcasting fees, because people wouldn't want to advertise them because the advertising's so ineffective at getting the money?
I'm not sure who that was.
You know, Stephen Joyce.
Oh, right.
Okay, the current government communications minister. Don't you think it's a conflict of interest for somebody to be in a CEO of a major corporation, then brokers a deal to bail out that corporation, the former CEO is, as the communications minister for the government, which incidentally then gives the Prime Minister the Prime Minister's hour, cost-free, in the middle of an election?
Yeah, yeah, right? Most definitely.
That is New Zealand corruption for you. Because he's a CEO, because he's a minister... It's not corruption.
Mm. Yeah, it's definitely a wee bit dodgy, I think.
Yeah. Mm. And so my point is that mainstream media, despite their best efforts, can no longer make profits off of lies.
Mm.
And that's allowed people like me to start making money off of the truth. And actually, I get demonised and attacked. Yeah. Oh, Vinny, you're making money off the truth. Well, at least I'm not lying to people, bro.
Though at the same time, you'll have media organisations which have a clear bias. I mean, there's Fox News.
Yeah.
The Paul Henry Show. Very entertaining, love it, but obviously incredibly biased. But I think that's fine as well. I don't think that the media has a duty to be impartial. They're running a profitable company, so they do it however's fine. And you've identified a market where impartiality is quite important to you, so once again, that's working as well. So there's all sorts of markets.
I disagree, because somebody at Occupy Auckland a number of years ago came up to me and go, Vinny, I really like your news because it's not biased. And I go, that's not true. It's totally biased. It's just the kind of bias you want.
Yeah, I think that's fine.
I'm biased in favour of whatever the truth might be. I mean, I don't hold rigid beliefs.
Mm.
You know, I mean, if somebody produces me evidence that proves beyond shadow of a doubt that one of my previously held beliefs is wrong, I drop that belief like a hot potato really, really quickly, because I don't think that it's actually a bright idea to knowingly deny what the truth is because you don't feel comfortable with it.
Yep.
Right, and I think that's part of the problem with our country today is New Zealanders, my fellow New Zealanders, you don't want the truth anymore, do you? You know, I understand that it's painful sometimes, and it's quite frustrating to have your previously held beliefs challenged and eviscerated, but there's just no excuse anymore.
Yeah.
Really, we don't have a choice. We have to look at the things that are truly going on without that kind of one-eyed sort of approach, without loyalty to political parties, without loyalty to ideology. Let's look at the facts, let's look at the truth, and then let's run our society from that basis and that basis alone.
Yep.
I think that's pretty fair.
Yep, no argument from me.
You know? So, the old saying in World War II, if God be for us, who be against us?
Well, both sides thought God was for them.
Yeah. But you and I, we're for truth, justice, liberty, freedom, etc.
Yep.
Who could be against us?
Plenty of people, to be honest.
Yeah, and one of the things that I've discovered over my radio career, interviewing people like Thomas Sheridan, who's an Irish author of a book called Puzzling People, The Labyrinth of the Psychopath, where he goes into these personality traits of psychopaths. Now, the American Medical Journal states that a psychopath is a person who's generally smiling, very friendly, and very enchanting when you first meet them, but ultimately there's no depth to their personality. And they don't have any long-lasting relationships.
They don't hold jobs very well.
No, actually, they do hold jobs very well and usually get promoted relatively quickly and indeed manage to find their way into positions of power and control. Because that's the one thing that psychopaths crave, is power, control, you know. And it occurs to me that what the American Medical Journal goes on to state is that there are industries that these people, psychopaths, people with no conscience, basically what one would dub as the classical definition of evil, they become the power brokers of society. CEOs in business, politics, media, law, and medicine, and religion. If I were to ask you to describe the six central pillars of how public policy is made and influenced, you'd come up with those exact six pillars, wouldn't you?
Yep, that sounds pretty reasonable to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's unfortunate that religion has such a reach into politics.
Yeah. But here's the thing. What if most of them are run by psychopaths?
Well, I mean, that's probably a prerequisite for running a church, surely.
Oh, yeah. But I'm talking about a full spectrum again here. Mm. If we've got this this problem here with... what the heck is going on here? We're having a little bit of a problem with the screen behind us.
Bump the cable again.
Yeah. What occurs to me is that if the world is run by psychos, then they'd wind up implementing policy that would benefit their psychopath, wouldn't they? And what do we see happening nowadays? We see policy being implemented worldwide that actually benefits criminals rather than law-abiding citizens. If anything, it does the direct opposite. It turns law-abiding citizens into criminals that need to be surveilled, and it turns criminals that pass those laws into being holier than thou and being untouchable.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of merit in what you say there, especially when we look at things like gun laws, drug laws, private property regulations, etc. Now, in gun laws, certainly... remove the right of people to defend themselves and then enrich the criminals with guns. Same thing with drug laws and even the violation of private property rights, doing just regular things like building a shed on your back lawn, etc., which everyone should be able to do, can turn you into a criminal.
Well, I think I had an allegation in a local paper one time that a lady was trying to install a bird bath on her property in West Auckland, and it cost her $10,000 in consultancy fees from the local council.
Isn't that outrageous?
Outrageous. And
whose business is it?
And a friend of mine told me that he built his house totally illegally, totally without council consents. And then the council found out about it about 5 years later. And the reason why he didn't want to get the council consents in the first place is because he thought that it was far too expensive.
Which it is.
And then he got busted, had to go to court, spend a whole lot of time in court and a whole lot of money. And then he worked out, had he done it the legal route, it would have cost him nearly twice as much as doing it illegally.
And I recall a case where a landlord was prosecuted for, I think he had about half a dozen properties where he had made alterations which didn't get council consents. And you've got bureaucrats and ministers talking on the radio about how this is terrible and we've stomped them out and look out anyone else who does this. Yeah. What did he actually do wrong? Just exercise his private property rights.
And again, this is part of the whole behind the green mask UN Agenda 21 protocol.
Yep.
Eventually, there will be no private property except owned by mega corporations and where they're slaves. Right? I mean, basically, like from here today to then, that's the plan. And I think that this is actually probably the central thing that people need to really be studying is the implementation of Agenda 21 among local councils, because it surpasses all of the national sovereignty that we're supposed to be having. I mean, imagine if globalization achieved full fruition, that was one law for everybody everywhere. That meant if you didn't like the law, there would never be any form of escape. Mm. And in order to change the law, you'd have to change the entire world's minds.
Yeah, and I'm not a patriot or a nationalist. I don't get all wound up when I see a flag or anything like that. But the good thing about national sovereignty is that you can escape if the laws are oppressive. It's also one of the great things about the federal system in the US is that you can have so many different systems, and it gives individual states a chance to try a different approach, as they've done with cannabis legalisation, etc. It's unfortunate that the federal government now has so much power in the US to go in and override those things. So states' rights over there are fantastic, I think.
Well, they were fantastic until such a time as the federal government can wind up having even more than its fair share of power.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, I think one congressman stood up and he asked the rest of the Congress, what are the three branches of government? And they said, the executive, the Congress, and the Senate.
Which is not the case.
It's not the case. It's actually the federal government, the state government, and the people. The people being the central power structure, because it is the will of the people that tells each of those successive governments what to do.
I would have said the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary.
No, not at all. And it occurs to me that because people don't know how their country is supposed to be run, it allows it to be taken advantage of. Much like if a 16-year-old girl doesn't know what's going to happen to her if she gets applied with huge quantities of alcohol, she might wind up getting date raped. And I think that's what we've got, is we've got a nationalistic date raping going on. Cheers, bro.
Cheers.
That's what occurs to me. It actually kind of frightens me. It's like we're being taken advantage of and applied with these little schemes and little lies and what have you in order to create the society that somebody else wants. Not what I want, what you want, but people that are well out of the public eye. Right? You know how much Len Brown really controls in this city? Nothing. He's a figure, he's a puppet, just like John Key does. I mean, and if they weren't, why would they be passing the exact same policies as being passed everywhere else in the frickin' world? Why would Operation 8, a massive terror raid, happen in 17 countries at the exact same time if there was no global coordination? This is what globalization has done. It has reduced national sovereignty to the point where there is no freedom for anybody globally, period.
And when I talk about the benefits of globalization, I'm not referring to greater coordination by governments. I'm referring to free trade.
And free trade, again, as it gets sold to people, it sounds like a really good idea, but they've always got these little clauses to manipulate and destroy. I mean,
we're not having proper free trade, it's managed
exactly,
trade.
Exactly, like we're not having proper capitalism either. There's no proper liberty, no proper capitalism, and no proper free trade. Hello, global depression, anyone? Doesn't this make sense?
The closest examples we might see to pure capitalism would be in Dubai, where unfortunately your social freedoms are just about nil, and Hong Kong, but even that's not pure, but still pretty damn good, and they are very wealthy in both countries.
Yeah, apart from the people that live in the human battery farms called apartments in Hong Kong. have you ever seen this? There's a great article out
I did see that, actually, yeah.
I think that's again refers back to Agenda 21. That's how we're all.
It's unfortunate that people can choose to live in those things or not.
I don't know. Sometimes you're restricted. Your choices are restricted by how much economic power you have.
Oh, of course, right?
And I was just wondering, there's.
Imagine they passed a law to have minimum property sizes in Hong Kong, though. Just how expensive would property become?
Yeah.
It would be prohibitively expensive. Those poor people wouldn't even be able to afford to live in Hong Kong. I'd say they're probably better off under the current system. When Dick Hubbard passed the minimum apartment sizes here, what, about 8 years ago, something like that?
Really? He actually passed minimum apartment sizes? Did he make them smaller than the current minimum?
No.
Because I've been in some of these apartments, man. It was like, you cannot swing a cat. You can't swing a guinea pig in these things, man.
Yeah, I know. I mean, there really are some shoeboxes out there. It's not the sort of lifestyle I would want, but that doesn't mean that other people can't choose to do it based on their economic means. And, if we prevent them from making that choice, we're just forcing up the cost of property and making them worse off.
Well, yeah, in fact, that's
I live in a small apartment. I'm fine with it.
You're welcome to it. I was like, a mate of mine was doing some work around at a locksmith's in Remuera, and there was a two-bedroom unit that was in poor condition that was $750 a week.
Yeah, that's incredible, isn't it?
The property prices are coming have just gone out of control. I'm not saying they're going out of control, they are out of control.
I completely agree with you, and it is mostly government policy doing it. It's not just the council, though this urban limit does have a big impact on that. The amount of regulation and hoops you have to go through, the amount that developers are required to contribute to the council. I know everyone says developers should pay their fair share. That's fair enough, but it does lift up the cost of property, so you need to find a good balance on that. The Resource Management Act is hugely responsible for property prices as well. The restrictions it puts on what you can do with your land, the amount of regulations you have to follow, those all add up to these costs.
which is, again, part of it. See, that's the problem. That's the problem with Agenda 21. It's basically every single local government policy that's been implemented since the early 90s has fallen basically underneath this exact model of the agenda for the 21st century. It was signed by Jim Bolger, George H.W. Bush on Prince Charles's private yacht in 1992 at the Rio Earth Summit. And that's where this whole thing started. And I fear for the implementation of this. And you know, it's about throwing a spanner in the works and throwing up everything. But, you know, sometimes I get really sad, Stephen, that the domination has gone too far already. And even if we've got good ideas and even if we stand up and fight for them, will be up against such opposition by brainwashed masses who will fight to defend a system that enslaves them.
And one that's made them comfortable and dependent.
That's really depressing. Sorry, ladies and gentlemen.
I think when you get involved in politics, you go, I mean, like when I got involved in libertarianism, there was this initial, wow, this is a fantastic idea, I can't wait to tell people about it. And then I started telling people about it, and it was all the same oppositional arguments, and I'm going, oh, why don't they get it? And then eventually it's a few years to, oh, I'm disillusioned, I'm taking a break. And I had a few years off.
Yeah.
A
friend of mine actually got criticised by somebody and saying that they were wrong because they were disillusioned. And I was just like, hold on, disillusioned means the removing of an illusion. So
I think it means you're right.
Exactly. Like, well, hold on a second. Are you telling me that I'm incorrect because I'm no longer operating under a delusion?
I mean, I think a sense of skepticism and cynicism is probably a wee bit healthy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. Really positive, but I'm also a little bit negative at the same time, you know?
Yeah.
And I have this this great vision of a united world where people actually defend each other and I don't know, like... What they've been doing in the States right now, outside the Super Bowls, we've heard a couple of American talk radio show hosts talk about this, is there used to be these things called tailgate parties. Have you ever heard of a tailgate
party? No, I haven't.
Well, out in the parking lots of big Super Bowl games and things like that, you have hundreds and thousands of people. They put down the tailgate of their car and they've got a barbecue set up or something like that, and there's kids running around and playing everybody.
Heaps of beer.
There are heaps of beer, you know, as you do. And people were having fun. It was like a community sort of effort, you know.
God, that would never happen in New Zealand.
Yeah. I mean, and now what they're doing is they're actually banning that from happening outside there. Oh, because it's a security risk, you know, because one of the terrorists that the government funds might find it difficult to get in past all these tailgates. I'm FBI, I'm coming through. Isn't that a bomb strapped to your chest? Yeah, but I'm FBI, I'm coming through.
Oh, that's so sad that, you know, even spontaneous fun amongst, you know, strangers just getting together and enjoying each other's company could be banned.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're...
It's just like the public liquor bans we have around here now.
Yeah. That actually really sucks, you know. There's fire bans, liquor bans, there's all kinds of bans.
Yeah.
They got more bans than fucking Big Day Out.
Yeah. And I'm willing to concede that possibly a liquor ban might result in less broken glass in a public park.
Yeah.
Probably does. But does that make it the right thing to do? I don't think it does. You shouldn't have a blanket punishment for everyone when a few people are doing the wrong thing. Get the police to do their job and punish the people doing the wrong thing.
Yeah, either that or you've actually... Maybe we don't need laws. Maybe we need basic understanding of common law and personal responsibility, and that would actually eliminate the need for most laws, because people wouldn't do things that are wrong in a culture where doing the wrong is the wrong thing. Yeah. It's not something you do.
Well, that would take the wide-scale cultural change I don't think will ever happen.
Yeah.
Even I think we need some laws, but just not too many.
Yeah. I mean, it comes down to this. If you want to do something simple... if it's part of your private property or whatever, if you do it and you're not hurting anybody or damaging anything, then the law should leave you alone. You know, Am I hurting anybody? No. Am I damaging anybody else's private property? Am I doing something with my own property? Yes, you are. Okay, well, the law, get the hell out of my life.
Yep.
You know, and stay out.
Yep, I think that's pretty simple.
Until such a point as I actually do something which hurts or damages.
Yeah, if you're firing off fireworks over onto your neighbours, you know, that's a time for the police to step in.
Yeah.
If you're building smokestacks that are polluting the air around the area, you know, that's where the law steps in.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, well, and that's if the person next door can't resolve it with that other person themselves. Mm. And I've also noticed that we've had a detachment from natural justice as well as a detachment from natural law.
Mm.
If people are going to be living together in a peaceful, happy society, don't you think it would actually be the first port of call to go directly to the person next door that they have a problem with, rather than calling noise control or the police first of all? Unless, of course, that person becomes disruptive and or violent and there is a necessity for the police. Because otherwise, if it's just, you should have come over and talked to me, bro, I would have done it. You didn't even invite the cops round.
That
kind of thing, if people could be amicable like that, it'd be nice. What's problematic about this is television.
You've seen Neighbours at War?
Yeah. I've seen Neighbours at War, and I find if those neighbours weren't at home watching Neighbours at War, they wouldn't be at war because they'd be talking to their neighbours more. Don't be a duck bag. I mean, that's pretty much the that should be the law.
Yeah.
You know, property laws. Don't be a duck bag.
I think that's a pretty good law.
Yeah. It's pretty straightforward.
Yep.
Be a bit draconian, but still.
And I mean, our court system can deal with most of these things. Well, you know, under the theory, our court system should be dealing with these things rather than having blanket regulations telling us what the rules are.
Yeah.
You know. Talk to your neighbour. If that doesn't work out, deal with it through the justice system.
Mm. Have you ever noticed how, or at least in my theory, that stupid laws keep getting followed by stupid people? And they get really stupid people to force intelligent people to follow those laws blindly.
Yep.
Until eventually everybody becomes so stupid that they don't even know that there's a law.
Well, there's some people who think that following the law is a moral
obligation,
it's the highest moral calling in itself, no matter what the law is. I mean, we've seen what disastrous effects bad law can have throughout history, but some people think, I'm following the law, I'm doing the right thing.
How long did it take for humans to forget that when you obey people in a uniform, they eventually take control and dominate and exterminate you?
It used to be the law, report your neighbour if there's a Jew in the house. So following the law in itself isn't a moral calling at all.
No, not at all. And I think what's happened is the moral fabric of society in and of itself has become disintegrated.
Mm.
We've gone through the public education system,
which has taught us the value of following all authority.
All authority. Where is the moral authority if the only thing you got is authority without morals?
Mm. Well, there isn't any.
I think that's actually a nice positive place to leave it. Okay, so we want to wrap this off now, ladies and gentlemen. I really want you to, please, if you can, attend the Len Brown protests on this weekend. Was it on the Thursday?
It's on the 22nd of February.
The 22nd of February, sorry.
Yep.
And
12 noon at Brito Mart.
12 noon at Brito Mart. And were you marching up to Altair Square or something?
We will be going up to Airedale Street via Queen Street.
Where's Airedale Street?
It's a wee bit off Queen Street, not too much. We tried to get Aotea Street. That was booked months ago by some day of prayer, so we're going up to Airedale Street.
Okay, the day of prayer dominates the day of political. That's ironic there.
Yeah, I might pop around at 10 o'clock and do a flyer drop and see if they come down and join us.
Yeah. Well, you never know.
Yep.
Religious people allegedly have morality, you know. And
they'll be upset about the affair, even if I'm not.
Do you think Len Brown actually has morality? Considering what he does? Like, you know, trees by their fruits? What kind of a person who has morality would use corrupt credit card payments, lie to everybody, increase all their rates, and have a bit of a freaky day here on the side for 2 years behind his wife's back?
Yeah, well, I guess different people think that their views are moral. whether they might be different from another person's views who they think are moral. So maybe Lem thinks he's still moral, but I certainly don't.
Okay. I think that's pretty straightforward.
Yep.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, the Len Brown stand down protest. Why does Affordable Auckland demand Len Brown stand down? Join us on a march from Britomart to Airedale Street, 22nd of February. Leaves Britomart at 12 noon. Too many lies, rates too high, sex on the job. What kind of a job? Ooh, okay. And with that, thank you, Stephen Berry.
Thanks very much.
Wonderful interview, mate. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right.